Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call into session the December 9, 2014 session of the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Welcome to everyone. We have a full house today, as well as a full agenda. Committee members, thank you for your presence. Folks, this should be a very interesting afternoon. We may have to be a little strict on the time element in terms of how much testimony everyone is allowed, simply because we have to be out of this room by 5 p.m. And we've got forest health and biomass, pollinator health, pesticide use, an overview on aggregate use, and the introduction of committee bills. It's a full agenda. And so in advance, if I have to ask you to speed up your testimony, my apologies. Please understand that I have time management issues here. With that, I'd like to call up first, please, on the issue of forest health and biomass, Doug Decker, state forester. And Doug, are there other people that would make sense for you to bring up as well? Come on up, please. I'll let you construct the panel here.
Okay, very good.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation to be here.
Bruce Doc Savage, it's been a dog's age. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester, the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm joined by this afternoon by a number of our forest biomass partners, the biomass team here, and Palmer Mason with DEQ will join us up here in just a moment. We're going to be talking about the opportunities and the challenges that are associated with utilizing woody forest biomass. You may recall that we'd hoped to focus in on this work when we were before you in September.
Yes.
And we kind of packaged this in with federal forests, and we spent most of our time talking about federal forests, and we didn't get to biomass. So today is we're going to focus in on biomass. Marcus Kaufman. I'm joined today by Marcus Kaufman. Marcus is our ODF biomass specialist. Bruce Doc Savage from Ochoco Lumber, Palmer Mason from DEQ. And over the next 15 or 20 minutes or so, we want to really talk about that connection that exists between forest biomass and forest health and fire risk and rural economic development and air quality. Forest biomass really exists at the intersection of those different elements. In October, Brett Brownscombe and Chad Davis and I led a legislative tour to the Bend Sisters area. Some of you were able to join us on that to look at federal forest work. And it was when we were with you in September, we had focused on that because a lot of the biomass that's available now is really coming out of the east side, where there is a significant amount of restoration work going on federal forests. We had the tour. We visited an operation west of Bend, and one of the things that we took away from that, one of the takeaway messages, was the need for further market development relative to biomass. There was one sale there that was particularly productive of biomass, and the material was being hauled all the way to Boardman because there wasn't a mature local market yet for that material. There are some localized success stories, and you're going to hear about them here this afternoon, but there's more that we can do to create new markets that help us to line up the supply of material that's out there while reducing the fire risk and really taking advantage of the abundant material, at the same time creating a more resilient forest landscape that's better able to withstand fire and infection and disease. So in that way, I think that our sense is that biomass can be transformative with the right marketplace. You know, it can address all of those different aspects, and it really is at that intersection. So I think Marcus is going to kick us off with talking about what forest woody biomass is, and we'll hear from Bruce, and then Palmer will come up. Marcus?
Thank you, Doug. For the record, my name is Marcus Kaufman. I'm the Biomass Resource Specialist for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm going to just walk through a few slides very briefly, if I can get this thing to work. So just so we're all on the same page about what we're talking about forest biomass, which can be in the form of slash, which is the tops, limbs, defect, as well as material from insects, disease, and damaged wood. And this can be both in the form of slash, which we pile up, or in round wood. This is a plentiful material. As Doug mentioned, the restoration efforts on the east side are producing large volumes of this material, and as collaboratives are getting up to speed and treating larger landscape acreages, we're seeing that more and more of this material is coming off the, particularly the east side. So there's a number of benefits of using forest biomass, and rather than walk through this list, I'll give a couple examples of the way this is playing out on the landscape. The Deschutes National Forest in around Central Oregon has been using stewardship contracts for about half a dozen years around the communities of Sisters and Camp Sherman. And when they put these stewardship contracts together and there are markets for the biomass, for the tops and the limbs, they've seen that they have a reduction in their cost of doing business by about 50%. And they're also able to have quicker implementation. And the reason is that when they have the biomass, they essentially skip steps in the process of restoring these lands, so that they don't have to burn the piles, they don't have to make the piles, and they don't have to wait for the time for those piles to cure. So all of those steps that they don't have to do because a contractor comes in and chips that material and removes it and sells it to a market, that results in a cost savings to them as well as quicker implementation. So some of the numbers that they've shared with me is, you know, when they have markets for utilization, it can reduce the cost to about $175 an acre. When there's no markets for utilization, you know, when markets change or they're in a different place, those costs can be $380 an acre. So there's a fairly significant benefit there. In terms of the speed of implementation, oftentimes it takes 2 to 3 years to complete the course of work that the Forest Service lays out for themselves. And when they can have that implementation of a stewardship contract with biomass removal, they can get all that work done in 1 year. So you have cost benefit savings and the work goes quicker. So turn into a quick private land example. The MC Ranch, which is a 30,000 acre ranch southwest of La Grande, these folks thin about a million acres per year, mostly in small diameter material, 3 to 12 inches. And if they don't have a market for that small diameter material, they pile it up and burn it. The Enterprise School up in Northeast Oregon heats their school with woody biomass. They buy about 800 tons of that biomass a year from the ranch, and that supports about 65 acres of thinning per year. So with that material there, when they have a market for it, the thinning for that small diameter material, that becomes either break-even or sometimes a marginally profitable operation, and whether you're talking about that on private land or public land. So in addition to all those land management benefits, we see the job creation, and Bruce is going to talk a little bit more about that. And then I'm sure as the committee is aware, the EPA has recently come out with a memo noting that certain sources of forest biomass and manufacturing residuals can be considered a carbon-neutral source of energy. So that's a very positive step as well. So if biomass has such great benefits, why aren't we seeing more of it? Why don't we see more utilization? And the challenge is market conditions. We see very limited markets for large-scale uses of biomass. The biggest use that we see around the state is for renewable energy in terms of electricity, and that price is very low because we price renewable electricity based on the price of natural gas, which is at an all-time low. We've seen small but growing demand for thermal energy, converting public schools, hospitals from expensive fossil fuels to woody biomass. But that market really hasn't seen widespread adoption yet. We're seeing other markets like liquid fuels and biochar beginning to emerge. And there's interest in exporting industrial pellets to Asia, which is another emerging market. So as we think about market development, if we want to see more of these benefits, essentially we're at a point where there has to be greater consideration of a public investment. And as we think about that market development, some thoughts come to mind. You know, we obviously want to link to state and federal priorities, federal land being one, rural communities being another. And because markets change, we want to be technology neutral and product neutral to avoid picking winners and losers. And I would just give an example of what some of that market development has looked like from ODF. We have a program called the Cohesive Wildfire Strategy where we've provided early stage feasibility and design funding to businesses that are looking to use biomass. So we provided an $18,000 grant to Integrated Biomass Resources in Wallowa County. They took that and went and got a loan, a new market tax credit, for $3.4 million. Then they added 15 jobs and increased their utilization of restoration byproducts by 50,000 tons. So that's the kind of market development that we've had experience with in the past and would I think, help grow that market into the future. So that's all I have. Thank you for your time. I'll turn it over to Bruce.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. It's good to see you again, sir.
Great to see you.
As previously stated, my name is Bruce Doc Savage. I'm the president of Ochoco Lumber Company. We're based in Prineville, Oregon, with a sawmill and a biomass facility in John Day. We're right in the heart of the forest health issue that we've been talking about for the last few years. Our company, 3-4 years ago, was looking at shutting down in John Day. We couldn't find the raw material necessary to operate our sawmill. With the help of a lot of different people, in particular through something called the collaborative process, we were able to work with members from the environmental community, the state, from organizations such as Nature Conservancy, Sustainable Northwest, and develop a process whereby we now collaborate on our forest health issues. And we've been able to secure and be the recipient of an agreement called a 10-year stewardship agreement on the Malheur National Forest. In theory, this agreement will be a model for Eastside forest health resolution in the future. The agreement itself is made up of about $69 million of value to do work in the forest and to bring out biomass and saw logs. Because of that agreement, we were able to hire in the last 6 months 52 new employees for our mill over in John Day. We installed a pellet facility, a whole log chipping facility, a log shavings facility, and we're able to take that material that Marcus described and pull it out of our saw log material and create biomass. Currently, we have a very stable timber supply. I know this sounds unusual, but due to the certainty of the stewardship agreement, we're very comfortable where we stand right now. In fact, we want to make more investment in our facility to be able to absorb this biomass facility. Got a little issue right now with emissions in our permit, but we're working through that. What would we like to see happen is we would continue to hope for help, as we've had in collaboration with other groups and with the state, to help us with some of this market development. We currently can sell all our biomass, but we want to get larger, and it's very possible because the material is there. Something to the extent of 100,000 ton a year in our area can be taken out of the forest. This equates to approximately 15 to 20 million board feet. The multiplier for jobs is about 11 per million. So you're talking about whatever the calculation is, I guess it'd be 165 somewhere, new jobs that could be created. When we hired 52 more people this spring for our operation because of the biomass availability, the logging community matched that number. The Forest Service has estimated that 288 jobs have already been created because of this 10-year stewardship contract in the Malheur area. So whether it be grant and loan programs, some type of energy development, help with market development, we would certainly like to see the state jump in, as some other states have with investments. Maryland, for example, the state of Maryland has a grant program to encourage the implementation of biomass programs for their public health and their public-owned wastewater treatment facilities. New York State has an R&D renewable credit available. As previously stated, the EPA has said that they recognize that part the carbon benefits of biomass. We currently sell bulk pellet to two hospitals, two schools, and the regional airport, plus five other bulk recipients of our biomass. The schools have reduced the cost of fuel. Remember, we're in areas where there is no natural gas. This is a very good alternative and a cheap alternative, plus we're doing good things in the forest. We'd like to expand on that, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay. So oftentimes in the conversation about biomass, a question gets asked about air quality. What are the impacts from biomass utilization on air quality? What are the impacts of catastrophic fire during the summer on air quality, and how do those relate to each other? Okay. Wanted to ask Palmer Mason from DEQ to come up and talk to us a little bit about how the air quality permitting piece kind of fits in with the biomass equation.
Thank you, Doug. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Department of Environmental Quality.
Welcome.
Thank you. You've asked me to be here today to talk about biomass and air quality. There's two things that I really want to focus in today. I want to talk just briefly about the health impacts that come along with burning, and that's true whether you're burning biomass or anything. And then more specifically and more importantly, I want to talk a little bit about the permitting of biomass facilities and what's required of the department to do that. So first, with regard to burning, burning of any kind can have an impact on air quality. It can produce a number of different pollutants from carbon monoxide to benzene to particulate matter. And the pollutant that's of particular concern when you're talking about burning and would apply to biomass is fine particulate. And that is a particulate that has a size of 2.5 micrometers or less. And if that sounds small, it is very small. Those particles are about the diameter, 20th the diameter of human hair. So the issue with fine particulate is that that small is easily inhaled, and it can enter the lungs and cause respiratory issues, and it is so small that it actually can enter the bloodstream and cause other problems. So that's the health concern associated with fine particulate and particularly combustion. When you talk about DEQ's permitting of biomass facilities, we have permitting requirements that apply when the facility is producing at least 10 million BTUs per hour. And there are facilities that we have permitted at that level. There are also a number of other facilities below that 10 million BTU per hour threshold that do not get permitted under current DEQ rules that do burn biomass. So some of the schools that use biomass for heat are places that fall below that threshold. Wood stoves in particular are sources that fall below that standard. But then again, there are definitely industrial biomass facilities that we have permitted that are above that standard. And Marcus mentioned some examples. I wanted to give you some others. There are lumber mills where the energy from the biomass is used to dry green lumber. So an example is the Collins Pine Company sawmill in Lakeview. Another type of facility that we've permitted is a pellet mill where the energy from the biomass is used to dry wood material. There's an example of those facilities in John Day. Co-generation facilities where energy from biomass is used to produce steam and electricity. The Interfor facility in Gilcrest is an example of that that's been permitted. And finally, there are power plants where energy from biomass is used to make electricity, and Biomass One in White City is an example of that kind of facility. When DEQ goes to permit a facility, we're looking at the impact of that facility on the entire community. So that will involve things such as the facility itself, its location, the topography of the community, weather patterns, and then certainly the level of emissions controls. One of the challenges that we have here in Oregon is we have some communities that under the federal standard either exceed the federal standard for fine particulate or are very close to that point. And that makes the permitting of those facilities more difficult certainly not impossible. There are facilities that can get permitted in those places, but it does make it more challenging. And I want to talk a bit about that federal standard, because that's key here, I think, to the discussion about permitting biomass facilities. The federal standard is 35 micrograms per cubic meter of air. And the way the federal regulations work is that a facility is going into an area, the contribution from that facility is added to the contributions of all the other sources, including unpermitted sources. So another way of saying that is if we're in a place where the air is already constrained, there are sources, unpermitted sources in particular, contributing to fine particulate problems, then a facility going into that area, again, faces a more difficult road to getting permitted. Our rules do allow, in most of our places where this is true, for the facilities to get offsets. So a typical example of that is a facility that wants to get permitted in that situation or in that place would basically buy out old wood stoves and convert them over to new wood stoves, and that allows them to meet the permitting threshold. But again, I just want to emphasize for the sake of the committee, the way the federal regulations work is it is a community standard, and all the sources get totaled up, so that counts against, as it were, an industrial facility coming in. And I want to say about the industrial facilities, most of what we're talking about are facilities that are well designed, have high levels of emission controls, and well maintained, but they do face that issue because it is a community standard. I'll close by saying that at DEQ, we recognize that when we're talking about biomass utilization, we're talking about locally generated fuel materials, and that they have a number of benefits, in particular to forest health and to rural communities for economic development, and we certainly recognize that. But we think it's important to, as we look at those issues, to also look at the air quality impacts. And I say that not just for the sake of the people who live in the community and breathe the air, but again, going back to the discussion around the federal standard, it's important to look at the air impacts so that the permitting burden, the permitting responsibility on the industry isn't any greater than it has to be. And then one last point on related to that is, there is a huge opportunity, I think, to look at the unpermitted sources, the older wood stoves and some of those things, and if there are opportunities or policies to look at trying to convert older stoves to newer stoves or have stoves use better fuel, better pellets, what have you, then I think we can have opportunities where we're potentially generating more jobs in rural community as well as cleaning up the air. So with that, I'll stop, take any questions.
Thank you very much. Committee members, any questions or comments? Representative Whitsitt.
I have a comment. Lakeview, Klamath, and Oak Ridge are all close to exceedance levels in their fine particulate matter. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, Klamath Falls exceeds the federal standard. Mm-hmm. And has been determined or designated by EPA to be a non-attainment. Lakeview exceeds the federal standard, but actually hasn't received the non-attainment designation. And the non-attainment designation is important because it triggers higher permitting requirements for the department.
Right. So if I may follow
Please.
Up, some of the best areas for biomass that you have in the state of Oregon are close to those three towns. And so what's happening now, because they can't get permitted for their facilities, is the companies that own these massive biomass that where they've harvested timber already are openly burning them in the winter, and it's going to waste. It's going straight up into the air. It's not going through a facility. So we are, in essence, making things much worse because we're forcing the companies who can't get permits for biomass facilities to burn these massive piles, millions of equivalent board feet, straight up into the air. So I don't understand, what you're doing is actually making it worse by not allowing permitting of these biomass facilities, so they have to go burn them openly all winter long.
Representative, it's an excellent question. It's an excellent comment. The problem we face at DEQ is we're delegated a federal program from EPA. The EPA requirements are sort of at the end of the pipe or end of the smokestack, as it were. And those require that the facility not contribute to exceeding that standard that I talk about. But you're right, it's sadly ironic, as it were, that there might be materials out in the field that are getting burned and certainly contribute to air quality. I recognize that. But in order for us to implement the program as it's required by EPA, those are the requirements we have. So I understand your point, though.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Didn't we have a 10 micron criteria, say, 15, 20 years ago? And then that was changed to 2.5 or 5 and then dropped down to 2.5. And didn't we have non-attainment at 10? So how would they expect these municipalities to attain a 2.5?
So, Chair, with Representative Esquivel, I don't recall the exact dates, but you're right. The fine particulate standard has gone down over time, and I certainly recognize it gets harder for the communities as well as industry to meet a tighter standard. I'll give you the answer that I can give you. I don't know if it'll satisfy you or not. What EPA does is they look at the most current literature and science around the health effects that come from air quality pollutants like fine particulate. And periodically they look at that data and decide whether the current standard is sufficiently protective under the Clean Air Act. In the case of fine particulate, over time they made the decision that a lower standard is more appropriate. They then promulgated that standard, and it's a national standard, so it, you know, is binding in all 50 states, as it were, and that is the program that DEQ is left to implement here in Oregon. What we've tried to do is go into those communities and develop plans to work with the community so that we can find ways to lower the contribution from fine particulate, not only from industry, and not place all the burden on industry, but also look at the other sources, the wood stoves and other things like that. And those strategies are things that we do as much as we can in coordination with the community and the local stakeholders. I think we've had some success in getting people together to try to address those needs. As Representative Whitsitt pointed out, we've got communities that are struggling economically and not meeting those standards. The only other thing I guess I would say is that was why I brought up the point about trying to look at the unpermitted sources like wood stoves. I think, again, there's some opportunities there about trying to address that, because I think there you not only can generate maybe some local economic development and we can clean the air, but we may be able to make it where the people who are using the wood stoves have more efficient heat and things like that.
Follow up.
Please.
It's my understanding, and I remember this from when I was on the city council, we fought this battle before, and if my memory serves me correct, the debris off of your tires is larger than 2.5, the spin off of it naturally when you go down a road, and the other thing is if you get onto a non-paved road and get onto a paved road, that particulate level is substantially larger as well. Is that correct?
Representative Esquivel, I guess I'm not 100% sure what you're referring to. I mean, there's certainly pollutants that come from motor vehicles, and particulate can come specifically from, like, diesel emissions and things like that. And it's often true. This is more, as far as I understand it, true in urban areas than rural areas, that the air quality is not as good along congested roadways and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I would agree with that, but I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Alleyways.
Sure.
People, we have certain alleyways in certain communities that aren't paved. When they go out onto a paved highway or a paved street, the particulate level coming off those tires is substantially greater than 10, in fact. And same with the wear and tear on your tires. When it flips small pieces of material off the tire, it's substantially larger than 10. How do you combat that?
You know, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure I can really answer that question, and I'll have to follow up for you.
I appreciate that
you
very
bet.
Much.
Yeah.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Reardon.
Just quick question.
when Boardman, PGE's Boardman plant is going off of coal, and they had discussed using woody biomass, does that fit into this discussion at all? Are they, do you know if they're still looking at woody biomass? And
is that?
Representative Witt, Representative Reardon, thank you for the question. I believe they are still considering using woody biomass. It definitely does fit into the discussion. They would be using a very large volume of forest residuals. So I think I've had conversations with PGE about this. They're very much in the early stages of both understanding the supply as well as doing test burns with the technology for torrefaction. So it is something which I would characterize as that they're exploring it. I don't think that they've made any decisions other than to test the technology, and that's torrefaction, to see if they can co-fire it with coal or whether they can make a complete switch to burn torrefied material in their facility.
Okay. Thank you.
Committee members, looks like we've exhausted the questions. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the presentation. And with that, I'm going to ask, please, that Representative Reardon kick off the task force report, the report on the task force from pollinator health, please. And is Senator Thompson here?
Do we have to be good to him?
No, we don't.
He was
going to
try to make it, but
would Ramesh? Ramesh?
Thank you.
I think it's just you and me.
I think so.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt and esteemed committee.
Good afternoon.
My name is Jeff Reardon, State Representative, District 48. And I have the easy part today. I get to represent and share a little bit about the task force. And I'm here to report on the Governor's Task Force for Pollinator Health. And what I would like to do, as you know, if you've been on one of these groups, a lot of work, very little glory. So I want to take at least a moment to introduce the people. And a few of them are here today.
Very good.
And there are people that were not on the task force that really contribute a lot. So no particular order. Gabriella Goldfarb, if you see her, she's out of the governor's office, helped form this committee, and was provided some excellent guidance along the way. Our very own Beth Petrino was absolutely amazing. Kept us all on task, wrote a great job incorporating all the different comments, and we all know what a gem she is, and especially on this project. Rose Kachadorian, who is from the Department of Agriculture, couldn't actually technically sit on the task force, but she provided so much information. She's the person that works on a daily basis with the Environmental Protection Agency and knows the details of these things. It's just a tremendous resource. Task force members, on my right is Ramesh Sagili, chair, from the Department of Horticulture at Oregon State. If you got questions about bees, he's a man to see. Senator Chuck Thompson, who I thought was going to be here, was also on the task force. Senator Thompson and I were non-voting members. Ame Code, who could not make it up here today, represented Xerces Society, a tremendous resource. Scott Dahlman, I believe, is sitting in the back there, and Oregonians for Food and Shelter, a gentleman and an excellent resource all the way through this this process. George Hansen, I also saw in the room. George, if raise your hand if you're out there. Beekeeper. And again, somebody that every one of these people is such excellent resources. Rich Little, master gardener, used to work at Department of Ag in California, brought vast knowledge and experience from that. Christy Split and Doug Moore did a little time sharing on, they're both from Oregon League Conservation Boaters. Christy went off and had a baby, Doug took over. And Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. Super resource, always that calm voice of wisdom, and so a real asset. What I really think was amazing about this group, and I'm very proud of, is that we were able to bring people together. together and in a good Oregon fashion, really had a great exchange of ideas. And it was done in a respectful manner. I think we took a very divisive issue and through a lot of talk and a lot of listening, used a very consensus-driven process to come up with the recommendations that you're going to hear today. And I think it balances the need for pesticides with the need to really protect pollinators. And I feel that it was important that we try to achieve that balance. And so that's what I drove for. I originally, you know, that this started out when I had this great idea, let's just ban the imidacloprid. I feel that we achieved a lot more by getting this conversation started. I'm hoping the conversation will continue in the future. And as you hear the recommendations today, I think it's way better than a ban. So I feel really happy about all of that. Do we have all the answers? Of course not. Is everybody happy with the results? Absolutely not. But I think we need a really good start, and as you'll hear, a new beginning. So there are a few recommendations. Ramesh will give you all the details, but basically, one, develop a strong, effective outreach and education strategy. Got to do a better job of reaching the people that use the pesticides. Talked about that. Strong support for that. Fund a state-of-the-art bee diagnostic health facility at Oregon State. We need to do a better job of coming up with some best management practices and communicate those better. We have some ideas on that. And we even had agreement from beekeepers and from Oregonians for Food and Shelters on a way to help fund this. So that's pretty remarkable in itself. So again, glad to be here to answer any questions, but Ramesh has the hard part. And Ramesh, by the way, was a fantastic chair. So we appreciate working with him.
And Ramesh, if I could interject here, if you could, sir, help us keep on time, roughly 5 minutes, if you could summarize, would be greatly appreciated. And we truly appreciate your being here today. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Rep. Reardon, and good afternoon, Chair. Committee members here, the esteemed committee here. And so, yeah, it's a challenge. He gave me only 5 minutes, so I was prepared for 10 minutes, so I'll try my best. So I'll skim through my slides here. So Rep. Reardon wanted me to only go over. I hope you guys have the task force report here, but if you don't, then Beth can provide you a copy later to see. So there are too many recommendations here, but again, I just want to go over only a few that, only a couple of those in detail that Rep. Reardon wanted me to go over. So without any further ado, I'll start here. So these are the four recommendations. Again, you can find in the document that you have. And in the executive summary, we have listed those as well. So I'm going to talk about the second and the third one mostly here, about the state-of-the-art bee health facility that we have recommended in this one, and also the pollinator health research plan. But before getting into the recommendations here, I just wanted to reiterate the importance of bees here, just with this one slide. Just you can see on the top, that's how in a part of China they are pollinating at this time their pears. And we are very fortunate to have these beekeepers in the state of Oregon and in the United States who are using their bees to pollinate our pears and other fruits and vegetables and nuts. So I just gave you some numbers here. $20 billion worth of pollination in the U.S., about $500 million worth of pollination being done by bees here in the Oregon state of Oregon. And there are 90 different crops that are dependent on bees, both all included vegetables, fruits, and nuts. We already know 30% of the bees we have been losing for the past 7 or 8 years, I would say, and this is a national number. I have an Oregon number. I do a lot of surveys in the state of Oregon as well, if you're interested. So this is the most important part. I just wanted to give you a sense on the complexity of the problem. So honeybee colony declines are not simple to explain. They're very complex, multifactorial, and very dynamic in nature as well. So I'll just show you this is, again, another important slide which summarizes most of the problems that beekeepers are facing today. So we have parasites and diseases that have been there forever for bees. And then we have malnutrition problems because of lack of food diversity that bees are getting. And then, of course, pesticides and fungicides when bees are exposed when they're foraging in those cropping systems. And then beekeepers use some miticides in their hives to control that nasty pest called varroa mite. So they have to use, and those have some negative impact on bees as well. And, of course, we have a low genetic diversity. Again, I don't have time to go over those. But the crux of this slide is all these different factors that I have listed here are playing like a perfect storm. So they're compromising the immune system of the bee, and eventually those parasites and diseases that are listed on the left are taking away these colonies. So that's basically what the bee researchers have a consensus at this time. Just to show you what the varroa mite looks like, it's an ectoparasite, sucks the blood of the bee, transmits several different viruses. I have listed some on the right here. And you can see some of the bees are missing wings and deformed wings there. So this is a viral disease which is transmitted by this mite. And beekeepers had this huge challenge. About 25 years ago, this mite was introduced into the United States, and since then, it has played havoc on the beekeeping industry. We have a disease called Nosema, which is a gut parasite and also is a problem in temperate weathers like this here in Oregon. Bee nutrition, this is another critical area which has not been very well studied, and in my lab I do some research on honeybee nutrition as well. And this is very critical because I always say bee nutrition is the first line of defense for bees, and they need a very diverse and appropriate diet. And because of most monoculture and the hybrid crops that we have and loss of habitat and change in landscape, today we don't think we have that diverse diet that we were supposed to provide these bees. And even the CRP land, if we know the CRP land has gone down so much, which was a very useful thing for bees. And of course, pesticides, again, beekeepers had this problem for a long time. But again, the attention to pesticides only started since 2006 when we heard about this colony collapse disorder, which is still existing. So pesticides, again, there are several issues, but I just wanted to focus on those additive and synergistic effects here, because the honeycomb, where the bees are living, the home of the bee, is technically it's a sink for all these pesticides. So most of the pesticides are lipophilic, the term that I use there. That means it loves wax. So they get into this wax and can stay for years. So we have sampled wax for 10 years old, and that pesticide hasn't been used since then, but still we see traces of those. So this makes it very complex. So these are very additive and synergistic effects that we are looking at. And of course, we hear most about neonicotinoids because that's a class of insecticides which is largely used in the United States. Probably 25% of the total pesticides that we use fall under that category of neonicotinoids. And they're systemic. They are highly toxic. If we read the label, they do tell that it's highly toxic. And mostly the effects that have been documented in literature are basically sublethal effects on foraging behavior, learning and memory, and all those different sublethal effects that we categorize. And again, I say that realistic exposure for these neonics is a big challenge because we still don't have enough literature on what is the realistic concentration that affects these and what we are getting, because there are so many unknowns at this time on neonics as well. So I'm coming back to the meat here. Again, I don't have much time, so I'm just going to very quickly go over each of these recommendations. The first one, the reason why I gave you all these different complex scenario of bees is just to understand what kind of a challenge the beekeepers are going through today with all those complex problems. It's hard to tease apart each problem apart and say this is what is responsible for bee declines. So, and based on all these different complex factors that I mentioned, beekeepers today have a challenge to keep these bees alive. And for their sustainability, I think they need to be on top of those colony management issues. And without the support, like Oregon State University has a bee lab, I'm a bee researcher there, but still they need a lot of help to have those timely information for timely management. That's very critical for their hive survival. And that's a reason, one of the major reasons why the committee recommended to have a honeybee diagnostic facility at Oregon State University. And of course, we can use that for the native bees as well. I'm not ignoring the other bees because I work with honeybees here, but we should appreciate the services provided by the native bees as well. And especially bumblebees and some other native bees are also in decline, and we don't know those until we have a diagnostic facility and we can monitor those populations based on the results that we get by sampling. I think it's very critical. And of course, I wanted to also say that Oregon Department of Ag relies on our lab for looking at those bee kills. Whenever there is a bee kill, they send samples to us, and then we have to diagnose for pests and pathogens. So I think that's critical for having a honeybee health diagnostic facility at OSU. And then again, I wanted to reiterate here is this is a very separate recommendation that we are asking for establishing this lab and to help establish this lab, provide funding. And this has not been listed in the Ag Experiment Station funding budget for the biennium that every year OSU requests. So this is a separate thing we are asking, and this is a result of the task force recommendation. I just wanted to be clear here. And again, the other important recommendation we have is on integrated pollinator health research. And again, as you see here, probably there are Dave Stone and Jeff Jenkins and Paul Jepson at OSU. So we have an opportunity here. We have a diverse faculty, and there is a chance for doing a cross-disciplinary research, especially looking at pesticides, bee pests and pathogens, and bee nutrition. So I think supporting this recommendation would be very critical as well to understand all these different interactions we have with multiple chemicals and their exposure as well. And this is the last slide I have here on outreach and education. Representative Reardon already mentioned more about this. This was the strongest agreement we had with respect to outreach and education, where absolutely it's critical for having a pollinator health in a better state here in the state of Oregon. So you can read through all the document again. Again, I think I'm already gone over time. So I'll stop here and take questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very, very much. Committee members, is there a pressing question that any of you have or comment? Let's see. Representative Reardon.
Here, if I can make one additional comment. That outreach part, I want to really emphasize why there was such heated agreement on it. When you think about the issue that started all of this was improper use of sprays in the Wilsonville area killed off tens of thousands of bees, right?
Yes.
That was done by a licensed, educated applicators. The same sprays are used across the state by untrained, unlicensed people like you and me, and they get a label, basically, to read that. So we need to do a lot better job of raising awareness and providing good information about how to protect pollinator health. If we don't do it, we're risking $500 million worth of pollination in this state. And worse yet, we might see Rep. Clem out there climbing pear trees and pollinating. You know, and I'm really concerned about it.
Never get that image out of my head. Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much. And Representative Reardon, that's the perfect segue, I think, into our next section of the hearing today. Thank you both
thank you very much
for your report. With that, we'll move into pesticide use and regulation in Oregon, and I'd like to call up, please, Doug Decker and Lisa Hansen.
It's to mine first, if that's okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about pesticide use. I'm going to give you just a really high-level overview of how pesticides are regulated in Oregon. And then later, you'll hear from a couple of the experts at OSU to talk about the framework in which EPA uses to evaluate pesticides, and then some of the different type of uses that we don't always think about in terms of pesticides as well. And for the record, I'm Lisa Hansen.
Thank you and welcome.
So pesticide is a term it's an umbrella term for chemical products that are used to mitigate, repel, and eliminate a pest. There are several different categories of pesticides. Herbicides are used for weeds. Fungicides are used to kill fungi or prevent fungi. Antimicrobials are those disinfectants that we use in our homes and hospitals and other places. And then there are a series of other products as well. But I typically think of these as the sides, and they're meant to get rid of something we don't want. Pesticides are used in a multitude of different places. There are generally a couple categories that we think of. Household or general use products. These are products that any of us can buy at a big box store and use ourselves. In addition, there are commercial uses for pesticides. These can be the same chemicals that are used in those household or general use products, or the other category of pesticide would be restricted use. Those are the more toxic chemicals, and those require a license to purchase them and to use them. So this slide we put together just to illustrate the multitude of places in which pesticides are used. I think typically people think of them in the natural resource uses in ag and forestry, but pesticides are used in our home pools and spas. They're used for right-of-way weed control. They're used in industrial uses and structural control, as well as homes, schools, hospitals, healthcare facilities. The pyramid simply we put together to really illustrate how pesticides are regulated. The bottom orange part of this is the base of how pesticides are regulated in the United States. They're regulated by the U.S. Department of Environmental Protection through the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. I have to say that very slowly or else I get it backwards. And this, the FIFRA is the basis for all the registration, sales, and use of pesticides in the United States. In Oregon, we carry out some of those federal responsibilities through a cooperative agreement with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we also have the Oregon Pesticide Law, ORS 634, that has more stringent responsibilities for us as well. So just quickly, in terms of EPA's responsibilities, EPA is responsible for evaluating all pesticides prior to their manufacture, sale, or distribution. They use what's known as a risk-based analysis to do that. And simply put, that's risk versus benefit to determine whether those products will be registered in the United States. So key elements of FIFRA include pesticide products have to maintain a registration prior to any use in the United States. They go through a rigorous evaluation process in which a label is developed, and the label sets out the specific ways the pesticide can be used, how, where, and when. And one of the basic rules around pesticide is the label is the law. It really sets the basis and the specifics for how, where, and when a pesticide can be used. So in Oregon, as I said, ODA is the state lead agency for carrying out the regulation of pesticide use. We do some work that's related to FIFRA, as well as going beyond that through our other programs, which include licensing and recertification of pesticide users, registration of pesticide products for sale in the state. We do compliance monitoring as well as pesticide use investigations. And it's important to note that about 50% of our resources in our pesticide program are based on compliance and doing compliance work, whether that be complaint investigations or routine compliance monitoring that can be use observations out in the field. They can be records reviews of pesticide users, as well as in-store and dealer reviews, looking at products and assuring that the products that are on the shelf are registered for use in Oregon. So a little bit about licensing and registration. In Oregon, we issue about 13,000 licenses for different types of pesticide use. Some terms that are important for people to understand. Operators are the businesses that apply pesticides for others. So they are the business. They have to have a license to be able to apply a pesticide on the property of another individual. There are several categories of licensees under that. Those would be the people who are making the applications. And then another important definition is a private applicator. Those typically are farmers or foresters that are making applications on their own land. They obtain that license to be able to purchase restricted use and use restricted use chemicals. So what do we do in ODA's compliance program? Our compliance program is based on an investigation process. And our investigations are much like any other investigation for law enforcement or building a case to determine if something is lawful or not. And so when we do a investigation, we collect evidence. We do that through interviews, taking photographs, looking at the site and looking for visual symptoms of pesticide use. We review records and request records of pesticide applications, and then we look at the information that we've collected to determine if the pesticides are used in accordance with the law and the label. And then finally, if we find that there is misuse, we have the ability to take enforcement action. And there are a series of different enforcement actions that we can take, up and to issuing civil penalties and revoking licenses. And I'll leave you, this is my last slide. So we conduct between 200 and 250 complaint investigations annually. We do an equivalent amount of routine investigations. So those would be the records reviews, the on-site observations, as well as monitoring of dealers. Interestingly, ODA, one of our key performance measures is what the compliance rate looks like, or what our rate is for violation. And about 14% of all of these cases end up in some type of, in some type of a violation. Now, that not all of them will be civil penalties. Some of them will be notices of violation to bring things back into correction. But ultimately, it's our violation rate is about 14%. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Can you switch it to the other one? All right. We're going to switch gears a bit here and talk about the forestry side. Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Doug Decker, State Forester, joined today by Peter Doherty, the chief of our private forest division. We're here to talk about the forestry side of pesticide use and regulation related to natural resource protection that's in our portfolio. Peter's going to walk us through ODF's specific roles and responsibilities regulatorily, our monitoring, our enforcement, and our complaint response. You're going to hear a little bit from Peter and then from others, I think, later, the useful role that herbicides play, used responsibly and according to state and federal regulations, as one tool in a forester's toolbox. You're going to get a sense for the broader context of pesticide regulation in which forest pesticide rules exist and operate. And we're one small piece in this much larger picture that Lisa has alluded to. As we start here, I also think it's appropriate to remind ourselves about the importance of managed private forests in Oregon. The Oregon legislature has expressed this as policy in statute. Chapter 527 says it's the public policy of the state of Oregon to encourage economically efficient forest practices that ensure the continuous growing and harvesting of forest tree species and the maintenance of forest land for such purposes as the leading use on private forest land. I don't want to lose track of that statement because I think that it puts Oregon's private forest regulatory approach in context on these lands, our policy and our regulations. According to statute, must operate in a way that encourages economically efficient forest practices and that allow continued investments back in the land. And I think that's a key. A last point I want to emphasize before Peter takes over here is the Department of Forestry's commitment to clarifying both our complaint and enforcement process. We understand this can be confusing and not very user-friendly, and we're in the process of clarifying our rules and procedures and protocols, and I know Peter's going to touch on that in a moment. Peter?
Good afternoon, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Peter Doherty. I'm serve as the Private Forest Division Chief, and I oversee the regulatory enforcement on private forest lands. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the department's role in regulating, monitoring, and enforcing pesticide use on forest lands. Invasive weeds and brush often are often a significant obstacle to establishing new forest after harvest, which is required by Oregon's strong reforestation laws. By law, within 6 years after harvest, new trees must be able to outgrow competing vegetation. Unwanted reeds and brush can cost Oregonians millions of dollars. The cost for treating Scotch broom alone, combined with timber losses due to the weed's ability to compete, amounts to $40 million a year in Oregon. It's about 1.5 million acres are infested with Scotch broom. These pictures show the difference between an untreated and herbicide-treated stand. Oregon has more than 60,000 family forest, family and other forest landowners. Many of them use pesticides to establish new forest after harvest and create a healthy, sustainable forest resource. Typically, pesticide use occurs 1 to 3 times during the first few years after harvest, and then not again for 40 to 60 years. When the numbers were last reported in 2008, forestry pesticide use amounted for less than 2% of all applications and 4.2% of the total amount of active ingredients used statewide. Now let's turn to the department's role and responsibilities. As Doug mentioned, the department seeks to protect natural resources primarily on state and private forest lands while keeping forests healthy, working, and sustainable. The mission rests on the premise that healthy and diverse private forest lands provide value to all Oregonians. Statutorily, our role in pesticide and use and enforcement is narrowly defined and tailored to protect natural resources. Our forest practice enforcement and education program delivers this service. The Forest Practice Act, adopted in 1971, serves as a cornerstone in assuring public that private lands are managed soundly and effectively. It addresses a critical need of protecting our natural resources while providing a stable regulatory environment. Combined with these considerations is a commitment to prompt and thorough response to citizen complaints and concerns. The Forest Practice Act specifically regulates pesticide use on forest lands. As we just heard, this role fits into a larger regulatory framework that includes federal law administered by the EPA and Oregon's pesticide control law administered by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Other agencies, including Oregon Health Authority, Department of Environmental Quality, and Oregon's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, supplement the primary pesticide laws with specialized expertise and authority. This framework forms an integrated system to protect people and natural resources. It's important to note that forest-related pesticide use must comply with all applicable laws. So as background, the Board of Forestry first promulgated pesticide rules in the 1970s. It completed a major pesticide rule review and revision in the mid-90s, and the most recent comprehensive review of the Board's rule and its 12 related principles was in 2010 and 2011. And I'd just like to highlight some of the Board's principles in setting forestry pesticide rules. The ones to minimize duplicative regulations, create pesticide rules that are responsible, reasonable, and grounded in science, respecting the authority of other agencies, and developing forest pesticide rules in cooperation with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and working in concert with other laws rather than duplicating them. We continue to build on and strengthen this collaborative approach to regulation, enforcement, and complaint response. Now, pesticide use in forests is subject to provisions of the Forest Practice Act that apply to all types of operations, and these overarching requirements include notifying the department in advance, communication with interested members of public who have access to all notifications, and documenting special protections near particular resource sites such as spotted owl habitat. Additional requirements apply specifically to spraying. These include communicating with community water systems and documenting daily chemical applications. In addition, we have specific standard operating procedures that require a prompt, thorough response to pesticide-related complaints in coordination with other agencies. We've begun reviewing and revising these procedures in May of this year, and we'll soon finalize them. Now, specifically, the Forest Practice Act pesticide rule sets standards and best management practices that protect the waters of the state and streamside plants and other natural resources. As I've mentioned, these requirements are in addition to all other pesticide laws. Also, if a spill or misapplication occurs, we have requirements for clearly communicating and coordinating with other responding agencies. The rules also require the department to conduct monitoring to evaluate the effectiveness of our chemical rules in cooperation with state agencies, landowners, and other interested parties. Cooperative monitoring provides sound science that underpins our rules. We use monitoring results to ensure that the rules protect natural resources and water quality and to expand our employees' knowledge and skills. In 2000, the department published its review of the effectiveness of the rules for forestry aerial pesticide applications. In particular, we evaluated the rules to ensure that chemicals do not reach the waters of the state at harmful concentrations. The monitoring results showed that the rules are effective. Other monitoring projects support this conclusion. For example, the South Yamhill Pesticide Stewardship Partnership monitoring found that pesticide in waters adjacent to forest land were of minimal concern because of low instances of detection and concentration below benchmarks set by the EPA. An independent study, Eugene Water and Electric Board's 9-year study of the McKenzie River area, showed compounds associated with commercial forestry pesticide use were rarely detected. The study also concluded that forest pesticide use is not likely a threat to their drinking water. Turning to enforcement and investigation, anytime people feel that they've been impacted by pesticides, it's a serious matter. Our investigations and enforcement actions are triggered by inspections as well as by complaints. Although our regulatory authority is focused on protecting natural resources, we view our responsibility to Oregonians in a much broader way. We believe collaborating and communicating with other state agencies and most importantly with the public is essential to delivering quality services to protect natural resources. The Pesticide Analytical Response Center, or PARC, coordinates investigations among state agencies, and each agency determines whether a complaint warrants an investigation. The Department of Forestry refers complaints to PARC to ensure prompt, clear communication among state agencies. And finally, in all aspects of our work, we're committed to responding promptly and thoroughly and involving other agencies when their authority or expertise is required. Sometimes our finding may not align with citizens' perspective, and our job there is to explain our response. We're working to improve interagency and public communication and coordination around pesticide investigations. As I mentioned, we began assessing and revising our standard operating procedures in May, and we will complete that work soon. So thank you for the opportunity to explain the Department of Forestry's role in pesticide use on forest land, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we go back to the park slide?
Yeah, can you go back?
Okay, so can you help me understand how you're, so a complaint comes in and I'd like to understand how you respond, this is forestry in particular, how you respond to a complaint. Is an automatic investigation or not necessarily? And then when you investigate for your purposes, I think you referenced here that then you would refer it on to PARC. I just want to make sure I got it right. It's not automatically referred on to PARC and you do nothing. You get a complaint, then what happens, then what happens, then what happens?
So the first, when we receive a complaint, you know, our first response is if there's a concern about health, human health concerns, and there's a different response. And we have information about contacting an emergency or the Oregon Poison Control, which would be our immediate response if there's a health concern. We receive the complaint. We have a complaint form, and our offices are required to fill those out. We look at the background information, and then if it's a complaint that could perhaps involve a label requirement, we would automatically contact ODA because of their primacy for the label law. If there's any alleged or actual concern with human health exposure, then there's an automatic trigger to park as agreed by a memorandum of understanding. So that's generally how they would then move into park. With most of our pesticide investigations, regardless of whether there's a health concern, we coordinate with ODA because of the joint jurisdiction. And so we have a separate memorandum with the Oregon Department of Agriculture that sets up that relation to jointly investigate, because they'll investigate the label part, we'll investigate the forestry requirements.
So like in the one I follow, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
So like the one I read about in the newspaper where people were worried that either they, their spouse, or their pet got sick, that would receive an initial intake to you, a referral to park since it involved humans, and maybe if it's off-label drift to ag?
That would be correct.
Could you restate that,
yes,
please? What would be correct?
The me or him received
it. Chair Witt, Representative Clem, in the cases reported in the paper, those were a couple of investigations or concerns that were raised multiple years ago. But in the case where we have an investigation that raises a concern for public health, then that triggers a response to park. If there's a concern where we think there may be misapplication or label violations, we would coordinate with the Oregon Department of Agriculture because they take the lead on label violations.
Additional questions. I have next up, please, Representative Krieger.
Lisa, you mentioned in your testimony, your information, that the review of the records by the agencies, and who, you know, I do an application, a forest application, I got to put in a notification, but who all has access to the spray records? How would they do that?
So if it were a pesticide misuse or a pesticide-related investigation, ODA would have access to those records. We would request them. They would need to be provided to us for evaluation. That would be part of that investigation process, as well as I'll let Peter speak to the part that relates to what forestry requires under the Forest Practices Act.
Representative Witt, Representative Krieger, a similar process applies. If there's a concern for a forestry violation of a forestry pesticide rule, then we could request the application record and from you, and then we would have that application record. So when there is an investigation, you won't find that both ODA and ODF requesting the record. We would coordinate, and one or the other would request that record.
Thank you. Representative Thompson, followed by Reardon.
I want to drill down just a little bit more. You seem to indicate in your chart that the health effects are governed by OHA. Now, to make this the human side of it, if a physician has a patient that they believe may be impacted by a pesticide exposure or exposures, how does that play in? Where do they get their information? Where does a physician or patient log in on a medical way? I'm not familiar with OHA's Department of Pesticide Management or whatever. They have problems right now at OHA, so I'm kind of curious.
Chair Witt, Representative Thompson, there are a couple ways that this could work out. One, a physician could go to Oregon Poison Control, yeah, to get information. That is a quick response and with lots of resources to help them understand how to treat. If they want to know in a situation where we they need to know what pesticides were used, they could contact PARC or the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and we could request those. We would request those records from the pesticide applicator and provide that information to the physician.
Okay,
Representative Reardon.
Well, I'm just trying to put myself out there in the field somewhere, and I'm just an average citizen, and I think I've been blasted by a pesticide or something. Who do I call, and how long would it be before I would expect a response? Things of that nature. I guess I'm really trying to get at who owns the problem once there's a call.
Yeah.
Is there one person in this mass of people that really follows up and says, I'm going to make sure this issue is addressed in a timely manner? So it's kind of the way we do project management things, is make sure somebody owns that problem. And I'm just not clear to me here. So.
Chair Witt, Representative Reardon, complaints can come into, or concerns can come into, the Pesticide Analytical Response Center from a couple different venues.
Okay.
So one would be poison control. And that those, if they're human health related, those would be reported to OHA and ODA,
yeah,
for ODA to do a follow-up investigation and response. And that would be coordinated through the Pesticide Analytical Response Center. We have a staff at ODA that his job is to do that coordination between the agencies.
Okay.
When that complaint comes to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, as the normal course of business, we will make contact back within 24 hours with somebody to begin the complaint intake process and start that investigation process, mm-hmm, and the analysis to, okay, get that going.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had an email on this quite some time ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago or something. It's something about a spraying with a helicopter, and they got off course or something like that and sprayed a bunch of people or something, and people got sick and something like that or didn't feel well. And then they complained that they had talked to a forester. I don't know if it was a state or a federal forester. I'm not sure. But the forester indicated that they didn't have the authority to stop the spraying. That's troubling. Who would?
Representative Esquivel, Representative Witt, if a stewardship forester comes across a forest operation that is violating forest practice rules and or obviously violating the pesticide control law, we have the authority to issue a cease and desist order and to stop the operation. The particular case you talked about, the spray operation had been completed prior to receiving the complaint.
Okay, so it was a situation that I wasn't, because it's been a while ago since I've seen that email, but I mean, there was a problem.
Okay. And if I could...
And it wasn't the pesticide, it was the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
If I could bore down just a little bit on that response, we heard testimony that ODA responds to complaints within 24 hours. In the instance where ODF was expected, we could logically expect a cease and desist order based on some kind of violation. How long would we expect it to take for the department to issue that order on average?
Representative Witt, it's hard for me to answer that question because we haven't had that situation actually occur with a forestry pesticide application.
I see.
In this case, the Department of Forestry had an observer on site at one of the applications. There were five applications that were involved in this complaint. There were five separate applications. We knew there was concerns. The day that the operation was scheduled, which was a previous day, both ODA and ODF had inspectors on site. On the day following, when the spray actually occurred, we had an ODF Forester on site at one of the operations. It turned out not to be the operation that the pilot was flying between when the incident occurred, where his flight path took him over area homes. So we were on site during the day. We were able to respond to ODA's request for information regarding the different application sites and support them in their investigation.
That's helpful.
If I might follow up just a little bit to add some clarity to this, I think we're referring to a pesticide application in Curry County last fall, which was an unusual case for us. It was very, very complicated in working through it. During the case, we initially received complaints and began to respond. There were complaints that came in over a period of time. We requested records from the applicator. In this case, the applicator was not cooperative. We took samples in the neighborhood. When the samples came back from our laboratory, the results of the samples didn't match the records that we were given. And at that point, we were trying to sort out what had happened, and it was unclear. And so it was sometime in between us getting our sample results.
Yes.
And before it was communicated to the community.
Yes.
ODA has been very forthright in saying if we could do that over, we wouldn't do it the same way again. And the standard operating procedures that we have been working on through the Pesticide Analytical Response Center to codify how we will work together and how we will respond, I think we'll really begin to address these issues. But we recognize in the Curry County situation, the lack of communication really was a challenge, and we would do that different if we could do it again today.
Well, and Deputy Director Hansen, that's very helpful. And I mean, the line of questioning that I've been pursuing is trying to get to determining whether or not it is public policy in the state of Oregon to have, in essence, rapid response to emergencies dealing with illegal pesticide applications. And whether or not you were delayed simply because someone was uncooperative still suggests that you were being extremely timely. It is not your department's fault that that someone is out there playing the system, if you will. And I think that with the explanation that you've given us, it suggests that the department was very timely. Peter, you have suggested that I think, even though we don't have necessarily the cases that to point to, that we do have the policy that suggests that it will be a rapid response. And so I appreciate your answers on this, because it is critically important, I think, to reassuring the public that we have in place adequate regulations and responsive regulations for pesticide use and response. Representative Clem, I think you had a question or a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to help have Lisa reach back. There was a time, and I believe maybe it was 2009 or 11-ish, where there were complaints. I think they were maybe in Triangle Lake area a lot. And one of the things we were worried about was a capacity at park to be able to get out in a relatively quick fashion. And there was a small number of staff to do it. And it seems like we either diverted the fees from the old PURS program, or we raised the fees for pesticide registration to try and hire more people. But I got off the committee at that point in Ways and Means, so I don't know if we ever hired more people. So I don't know how staff capacity is there.
Chair Witt, Representative Klem, the current staffing for the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, we have a half of FTE funded for park. That person basically, though, spends almost 100% of his time doing park duties. The Oregon Health Authority has a half of an FTE funded for the pest program, and that's their piece of park in which they do interviews with individuals to assess the potential health impacts collect the data and use it for evaluation. So park has been funded back and forth between general fund and other fund over time and has had some challenges. But I think basically the simple answer is there's a half a time FTE at health, and then the staff at ODA, as well as what the other agencies contribute as part of our normal roles and responsibilities.
Can I follow up, Mr.
Please.
That doesn't sound to me like that many people, to be honest, to respond. So do we need more investigators for quicker turnaround time, or are they not the lead investigators anyway? They get a referral, and I'm thinking of the wrong kind of people.
So yesterday in Senate Environment and Natural Resources, during the hearing, the Washington Department of Agriculture and the Washington Department of Health described their programs. And I think it was really to do kind of a comparison and contrast of Oregon and Washington. What I took away from that conversation was the programs are relatively similar in terms of what we do, how we do it. There are significant differences, though, in terms of staffing between Oregon and Washington. And Washington was more heavily staffed on the health side, and I believe more heavily staffed on the pesticide side as well.
Committee members, with that, I'm going to try to draw this to a close, this panel. But before I dismiss you, a very broad question. But do any of you see anything that you need from this legislative body to assist you in your mission of being able to protect the citizens of Oregon and our environment against illegal pesticide applications and exposure? And I recognize my question is very open-ended. But when we are done here, I want to be able to give the greatest level of assurance to the public that we are doing the very best job possible to protect them and the environment. So I ask you that question.
Chair Witt, I would say that kind of following along the lines of Lisa's last comment, I think a very deliberate discussion about capacity mm-hmm. to respond, I think, would be very helpful in the full session. The other thing I think would be, from an awareness standpoint, to answer Representative Reardon's question about what do you do if you feel you're affected. In our agency, we had a very clear checklist that was literally on bulletin boards in every office that said, if you think that you've been affected by spray, this is what you need to do, and had a very specific mm-hmm. kind of a call down. Here's what you need to do. Call 911. Call the Poison Control Center. We're in the process with revising the SOPs. We're in the process of providing a clarity and crispness around that. I think the awareness that you can help us provide all the park agencies so that we can make that just completely visible and evident to folks would be extremely helpful. Those would be my two pieces.
That is very helpful. Anyone else? All right. Representative Krieger.
Just real quick, this application in Curry County, of course, is basically in my backyard with people I've known a long time. The fact that this applicator was uncooperative down to the point of false records and, I think, perjury mm-hmm. to you, I won't argue the $10,000 fine for him and the company each, I think it comes out to $20,000, but I definitely disagree that a one-year suspension is adequate. if anyone in this room goes out and violates one of the major game laws, they can get 2 years on each count suspension of their license. Now, there's a difference between the pleasure of hunting or being a guide and this man making a living, but he puts everybody who's in the forestry or ag business in jeopardy when he does that, and it 1 year is not enough.
With that, I thank you so much for your presentations. I am going to take you up on your suggestion that we bore down a little bit on capacity. I would like to ask that we have the opportunity to discuss that. If there are other committee members that are interested, as long as we maintain avoid a quorum, if we need to set up a couple of meetings, that's fine. I want the legislature to be responsive to your needs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
With that, a call up, please. Jeff Jenkins, Dave Stone, and Steve Tesh. Gentlemen, thank you for making yourselves available, and welcome to our committee. Please determine among yourselves the order of your testimony.
I think Chair Witt and committee, I'm Jeff Jenkins. I'm a professor and extension specialist at Oregon State University. I work in the area of environmental chemistry and toxicology, primarily with pesticide use in forestry and agriculture. I'm also a consultant to the Park Board. I've been asked in just a few minutes to describe how pesticides are regulated at the EPA. I'm going to move very quickly through this and hopefully give
you
the highlights
of
that process. So it starts off at EPA with some sort of evaluation and evaluation up front of a new pesticide. This diagram shows, on the left-hand side, shows the risk assessment paradigm that was established by the National Academy of Sciences in the early 80s. It's used by all regulatory agencies in the developed world. It starts with hazard identification, and so it's EPA's job to understand all, when we're talking about human health, it's EPA's job just to understand all plausible health effects of a pesticide. Then they need to know how potent that pesticide is. In other words, how much does it take to cause an effect? They need to know patterns of exposure. And then from this, they choose the most sensitive endpoint, and they use that as the driver for risk assessment. That results in a risk characterization that goes to risk managers within EPA, and they would make a decision if it involves registering a new pesticide. Do we register this pesticide or not, and under what conditions? There's also a re-registration process because science is always evolving and it's EPA's job to consider new science. So there's a re-registration process, and the registrants, which are primarily the chemical companies, submit new data either voluntarily or due to a data call-in. Most of this data comes from studies that follow a relatively uniform set of guidelines or study protocols that are also used for new product registration. These guidelines are harmonized within the developed countries, and I've listed just I've listed the guideline areas for which data is required, and I'm not going to go through all of these areas. The point here is to demonstrate how comprehensive the evaluation process is up front. If this was a new pesticide, to comply with all these guidelines could take as many as 10 years and usually cost more than $100,000, maybe closer to $200,000 for a new product. In 88, there were amendments to FIFRA that put in place the re-registration process, and so that's this ongoing re-review of pesticides based on new information. So they review new scientific studies, they update human health and ecological risk assessments using current science, then they make a decision to cancel or re-register uses, and they develop new risk mitigation measures, which usually results in label language, and we heard that the label is the law, and this is the instrument that's used to ensure that the use meets this criteria that's on the bottom down here, that any registered pesticide use or re-registered pesticide, they must determine if it can be used without unreasonable adverse effects on human health and the environment. So under FIFRA, there are no standards. There is only an administrative duty, and it's the duty of the administrator of the EPA to meet this standard. In 1996, it was amended with something called the Food Quality Protection Act, primarily focused on food. But this act said that human health risk assessment must consider aggregate exposure, so exposure from multiple pathways. And it also required that special vulnerabilities to sensitive subpopulations like children must be considered. And a new standard narrative was established. This is the standard of reasonable certainty of no harm. While this applies, based on the statute, only to pesticides in food, practically the agency is applying this across all exposure pathways. The way that EPA evaluates exposures is generally broken down into occupational and non-occupational, and this lists some of the different areas that the agency considers in detail when doing their risk assessment, which includes bystander exposure near agriculture and other applications, which is one of the areas, I think, of current concern in Oregon. So this all boils down to this process between the federal government and the states. It starts with this very extensive process up front. The risk assessment is very heavily front-loaded with a lot of evaluation before a product is registered. That's this risk characterization through sound science. Then it moves into a risk management phase, cost-effective requirements to ensure safe use. The risk mitigation is the label, clear understanding of label restrictions and use mandates, and then that translates to individual action, informed decision making at the front line of pesticide use. So this is the way between the federal statute and the federal-state partnership, how pesticides are regulated in the United States, and for that fact, in most of the developed world. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today. For the record, my name is Dave Stone. I'm a pesticide toxicologist and associate professor at Oregon State University, and I also direct the National Pesticide Information Center. Prior to my employment at OSU, I was a public health toxicologist with the Oregon Health Authority. The perspective I provide today focuses on many of the important roles that pesticides play in society and the benefits we derive from them. My intent today is not to minimize potential issues with pesticides, particularly when they are misused in violation of the product label or state regulations. Rather, it is to highlight their often under-recognized role in protecting public health and safety, as well as the benefits in environmental conservation. Before I summarize these important uses, I'd like to point out that when we talk about pesticides, we're actually talking about 1,100 different chemicals. These chemicals have been registered to control over 8,000 pests in conventional and organic agriculture, as well as many residential, commercial, and recreational sites. Because of the high standards needed to register a pesticide, as outlined by Dr. Jenkins, we know more about their health effects than any other classic compounds short of pharmaceuticals. As a result of all this information, we're able to develop restrictions and risk mitigation measures that enable pesticides to be used in our most sensitive places, schools, hospitals, assisted living facilities, and wetlands, along with our drinking water and food supply. Pesticides have long played an essential role in our state and around the world in protecting public health, a role that continues today. The number one use of a pesticide is through the chlorination of community drinking water systems to disinfect our water from microbial organisms. Chlorination has been one of the hallmarks of the Safe Drinking Water Act. Hospitals and clinics rely on antimicrobial pesticides for sanitizing and sterilizing instruments, hospital beds, and other medical equipment. Their use minimizes the risk of secondary infections among patients, and this includes the prevention of drug-resistant bacteria, such as methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, otherwise known as MRSA. Beyond microorganisms, many larger pests can harbor and transmit disease. In Multnomah County, there are 26 known species of mosquito, 9 of which are capable of vectoring human disease, such as West Nile. Careful applications of insecticides in mosquito breeding grounds are part of an effective strategy to limit their populations. Pesticides have been registered for direct application onto skin, clothing, and other products to repel mosquitoes and ticks, which can transmit Lyme's disease and other pathogenic agents. Rodent control is absolutely essential in society, particularly in dense urban areas. Rodents cause emotional and psychological stress for residents, schools, and businesses. Their presence can result in violations of housing and food codes. They carry several diseases of human relevance, including Hanta, plague, hemorrhagic fever, and rat bite fever. While many non-chemical methods are available as an integrated approach to controlling rodents, chemical methods are often needed as well, depending on the severity of the infestation and the physical constraints of the affected environment. In addition to the previous examples of protecting public health, pesticides have vital functions in public safety as well. Vegetative management programs for highways, streets, and other rights of way rely on herbicides to help make intersections and signage more visible to enhance vehicular safety, as well as preserve roadside surfaces and infrastructure. Utility companies rely on herbicides to suppress growth of vegetation that can interfere with power lines and disrupt transmission of electricity. In fact, the number one reason for power outages is overgrown vegetation. And additionally, anti-fouling agents are critical to maintaining water distribution and irrigation pipes and the performance and safety of marine vessels. One of the greatest threats to biological diversity and native plants and animals is the spread of invasive species. It is also an economic burden, with global costs exceeding $1 trillion to control their impact. Today, pesticides are absolutely essential to keep in the toolbox when we combat these pests. I've worked with government agencies, landowners, and nonprofits who are restoring native landscapes overrun with invasive species and who also place a very high value on environmental stewardship. Herbicides are often the chosen tool when mechanical and manual methods are not effective or feasible. This includes applications on steep slopes infested with invasive weeds or when the scale of a project makes mechanical control impossible. After the invasive problem is addressed, native plants and other habitat features can be restored. Herbicides are often the only way to successfully control many of the invasives in Oregon. Whether it's the spotted wing Drosophila in agriculture, the Japanese beetle in our shipping ports, or pervasive ivy in our parks, we often rely on them. Responsible pesticide use has other means by which it benefits conservation as well. With the widespread use of herbicides in agriculture, farmers have been able to practice no-till farming over millions and millions of acres. When farmers do not plow their soil every year to control weeds, this reduces or eliminates soil erosion to our waterways, retains soil nutrients, decreases fuel consumption, and sequesters carbon within the soil itself. The rise of no-till farming has been heralded as a quiet revolution in agriculture. Similarly, when we increase the yield of existing agricultural land, it reduces the pressure to farm natural environments. When we extend the longevity of utility poles or railroad ties, it reduces the demand to harvest more timber. And when we eradicate poisonous plants to livestock, it reduces the need to graze other grasslands. All these benefits are indirectly derived from pesticides. I will conclude with the observation that pesticides are not magic bullets, and they are not devoid of risk. I also note that experts predict that pest outbreaks will be more severe in the future as a result of a changing climate, demographics, and global trade. And in my opinion, pesticides will play a vital part in addressing the challenges ahead for Oregonians. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Stone, very much. Professor Tesh.
Representative Witt, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to visit with you today. My name is Steve Tesh. I'm a professor in the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. I've been asked to provide some perspectives on the use of pesticides in forestry in Oregon. My colleagues have covered a lot of ground already, so I'll try to add value here and not be redundant. We've already heard that the majority of pesticide use in forestry is herbicides, and it represents a relatively small proportion of the total used in the state. Some rodenticides are used to manage populations of mountain beavers and pocket gophers, where they're a challenge. In relatively rare cases, large-scale aerial applications of insecticides have been used to control outbreaks of defoliating insects, such as tussock moth, and in some urban forests, gypsy moss. We've heard that forestry in Oregon is highly regulated, that the reforestation process is required to begin immediately within 12 months and be completed within 6 years. What we haven't heard is that you can't harvest the adjacent stand until the green-up period is complete and green-up conditions are met. So this means speed is of the essence for many landowners to complete the process. landowners use pesticides to provide a predictable and consistent timing of reforestation processes. And we've heard that pesticide use is complete within a six-year period, and then none are used again for 40 years or so until the next harvest. Growing conditions for forests in Oregon are highly variable, and those in western Oregon are among the best for growing conifers in the world, as well as other vegetation. And this creates a competition for site resources that triggers a consideration for vegetation management and potentially pesticides. We've heard about the increasing challenges of invasive species and the additional challenges that creates in competition with our native native conifers that haven't evolved with these invasive plants. Reforestation keeps the whole process going. For young trees, this is the most fragile stage and the stage at which they can be killed or held back by unwanted plant cover. We've got this really scientific term called weeds that we apply to this stage, or by browsing by animals. Assuming that growing trees is the priority, foresters need tools to control weeds at this stage until the new trees are safely established. Foresters want to get this step right because the forest that is established at this point in time will predominate for many years, both in species present and in the number of trees present, both of which are key determinants of economic value and biodiversity. Pesticides are commonly used at two steps in the reforestation process. One we call site preparation. And these treatments are conducted to manage fire hazard and to prevent weeds and the habitat that they can provide from developing into a problem. After planting, release treatments are applied to manage emerging vegetation. But now the trees are present, and herbicide treatments must avoid damage to those seedlings. There's a relatively small window of time for applying herbicides when trees are not actively growing, but weeds are susceptible. Aerial application enables many acres to be treated quickly during this narrow window. Foresters have several key considerations when they think about vegetation management tools: their effectiveness, the cost of application, worker availability, and safety. Foresters have confidence that herbicides and rodenticides will work to accomplish their regeneration objectives, especially in a cost-effective manner. Helicopters are the primary tool of choice. Ground applications can be feasible, but are substantially more expensive. These aerial applications can allow effective control of large areas of seemingly impenetrable weeds like blackberries, scotch broom, and thistles. If you think about trying to hand treat a 100-acre patch of blackberries, you'll know that that's not a lot of fun. And according to various studies, both ground and aerial applications have a proven track record of keeping spray material within desired boundaries, which is a key consideration for public safety and resource protection. Are there alternative tools? Sure. Prescribed fire can work for site preparation, but its use has declined due to air quality restrictions. Large equipment can be used effectively for site preparation, but mostly on relatively gentle terrain. For release, handwork can be deployed, including hand cutting or hand spraying, but chemical exposure and physical injuries to workers become an increasing concern. And you might think about bee stings, poison oak, broken bones, and a variety of things like that. And increasingly, the workforce is limited for accomplishing this kind of work. In closing, because of the variability and complexity of Oregon's forests, the environments in which they grow, and landowner objectives, a one-size-fits-all approach to management is never successful. As you ponder this difficult issue of pesticides, It strikes me that a key outcome is to maintain the incentive for forest owners to continue to manage forests as forests, let me reiterate that, and not inadvertently trigger conversion to other land uses. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Committee members, Vice Chair Frederick?
If you might, don't mind. I have a question.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of things to say. One is my father is a botanist. He's a mycologist. And so whenever he was told me that a weed was just simply a plant growing in the wrong place. So that's something that I always have to, whenever I hear weed, I have to remind myself on that. And I have treated thistles by hand, hundreds of acres of thistles, which is no fun in Nebraska, let me assure you, as you're trying to chop them. But I am concerned about a couple of things. And I apologize for missing your presentation, so you may have gone over this, and if you did, I do apologize. The issue of biodiversity is important to me. And it's important for a number of reasons, but I think we see it happening as well in other situations where we have the ability for plants and other pests, if you will, to develop immunities to the pesticides that are placed that are out there. The herbicides of one form or another, plants developing the ability to resist the Roundups and the other things we use there, and. Because of the biodiversity, the good part about the biodiversity, because of that, the genetic makeup of our system, they are often able to develop immunity of some form, and so we end up putting more pesticides on, and we end up putting more and more. I think that recently, Monsanto has decided that it's going to include in at least one of its efforts. The ability to withstand three different pesticides because some plants in Roundup were managing to be immune to that. So that's one of the concerns that I have is how we are dealing with the accumulated load of pesticides and how we deal with the fact that we have a biodiverse system that can find a way around it. That's sort of the nature of that. How do we avoid the situation we're having right now with antibiotics, where we are in fact seeing lots of organisms able to really resist the antibiotics? We're seeing organisms also able to resist some of these pesticides, and so we're getting a double dose of some pesticides. What do we do about that situation? Any suggestions you might have, and how are we looking at that? How are you looking at that in terms of OSU's research?
I don't think any of us are doing research in that area, but it is a policy, an area of policy that I think that there's some interest in, particularly with the GMOs that are designed to be resistant to a particular pesticide. The Willamette Valley is very wet, and using fungicides in the Willamette Valley is there's a lot of potential heavy use of fungicides because of our wet climate. The leaf wetness is a very good environment for plant diseases. So there have been, through OSU Extension and through the University Experiment Stations, there's a long history of resistance management technologies and information resources that are given out to agriculture in Oregon because of this one particular area of resistance that comes about because the Willamette Valley is so wet and the disease pressure is so high. Resistance management has been high on the radar screen at EPA since the 80s, and it is the GMOs kind of threw a twist into that, but it's not something that hasn't been a lot of thought given to over the years. Before there was glyphosate, GMO cotton or GMO soybeans that were resistant to glyphosate. there was probably a half a dozen herbicides used on soybeans, and that was immediately reduced to one. talking about Monsanto now trying to put making GMO resistance for three herbicides, that's probably three or four less than the number of herbicides that were used prior to GMO soybeans. So there are some trade-offs there, and resistance management is on the radar screen in all of agriculture. And it's a known entity. It's something that's just part of agriculture. Sustainable programs, IPM, they all have ways of getting at resistance issues. So it's not anything new. No. It's been around forever. In fact, resistance is a part resistance is a part of ecology. It's a part of evolution.
I appreciate that. My background is such that I did molecular biology work as well, and so I'm particularly interested in this. My father has the reason he likes coming out to Oregon is because of so much fungi. So that's he has no problems with that at all. He likes taking as many samples of slime molds and everything else as he possibly can. But I am concerned because I'm concerned because I and other folks are concerned about the residue of the pesticides that may be found, and whether because the pesticides are so effective that there's an additional dosage that ends up being placed on those plants, because you can do it really well, you can add to it. And so there are folks who are coming to me frankly regularly worried about the amount of pesticide now being used, and it's the Roundup primarily, but it's the amount of pesticide that's being used and just how that affects how much is staying with the food that they're ingesting. That's the concern that I hear, and that with additional pesticides being used, they might also end up being dealing with that as well. So that's the concern that I have, and you're saying that we don't have much work right now at OSU on this. And no, I don't plan on coming to try to do any work on it, but I just find it interesting.
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick. I do deal a lot with human health issues related to dietary consumption and risk assessment with pesticides, and I completely understand why the general public wants to know more information about this or may be concerned about it. Fortunately, a lot of when we actually look at residue on a lot of the products in the U.S. marketplace, you don't find a lot. We do find more from imported foods than we tend to find from the foods we grow here, but it's still not a lot. And unfortunately, you can get a lot of reports out there that are fairly alarmist. And when they present the numbers, they'll often present numbers without context. That's really important. And so when you eat a balanced diet of fruits and vegetables or other products, your actual loading of pesticides from residue is really low. It's not zero, and it will never be zero as long as we continue to use pesticides, whether it's conventional or organic ag. But it is quite low. And a lot of the process that goes into registering a pesticide looks at those steps along the way about how long after a product's harvested or after a product's applied can you harvest it. And then often products get processed, which helps dissipate the pesticide residue as well.
Well, let me go to another, if you don't mind one.
Please, Vice Chair Frederick.
The other concern that I hear is the amount of pesticide that farm workers are exposed to as a result of some of the spraying of pesticides. How much they and their families, because in many cases they bring those clothes home. You know, I once fogged for mosquitoes as one of my summer jobs. I was covered with an insecticide and fuel oil, so I had to keep the clothes outside of the dorm because of that. But
that explains.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But I will say this: I also wonder just what kind of impact that has had long term on my body. because I don't know. And whether the, you know, the cancer that I have actually was prompted by that. So that's one of the concerns that I have as well. That is something that I'm hearing because, again, the fear is that there's an additional residue on food that is processed and it's picked, but also residue on the plants and that are then the workers are walking through and bringing home. So these are the concerns that I keep hearing about, and unfortunately, we have a lack of trust that some of these things are in fact true. Because we've had enough of these other things take place in the past.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Representative Krieger, a quick...
I'll be too quick, but it's important.
All right.
I want to preface what I'm going to say in the fact that I've had a tree farm for 43 years, and for 43 years I've used a backpack, and I, multiple times every one of those years I've got spray on me, even though I try not to. And sometimes I'm not in a place where I can go wash off. So I've had hundreds of exposures. Representative Frederick says, as he can tell, but I don't think I've had any health effects that I'm aware of as a result of that.
Sprayed.
So what I want to know is, what would you expect a health effect to be from a one-time exposure? I'm talking direct to a person, not on, you know, in your water or some plant you might have eaten. From a normal forest application, I realize we have different chemicals, but you're talking parts per million or per billion in most cases. And so is there anything out there that tells us what type of health effect you might? Because I know I mix it carefully, but I've had hundreds of exposures. And though I'm careful, and I think that if you talk to farmers and ranchers around, they're going to tell you the same thing. You know, you try not to, but you get it on you. Sometimes you can't get it off. You get home and you wash your clothes and take a bath.
I think that one's for you, Dave.
Yeah, sure. Chair Wett, Representative Krieger. It's part of the difficulty with assessing health effects and pesticides are a lot of the symptoms are nonspecific. They can be symptoms that overlap among the different types of pesticides, but also overlap with other types of issues that cause health effects: headache, nausea, diarrhea, very general nonspecific effects. From acute exposures, obviously what you're exposed to matters. As a general rule, and there are some exceptions to this rule, herbicides are going to be less toxic to people than insecticides or rodenticides. But how you're exposed, where in your skin you're exposed, our skin isn't the same thickness throughout. Age matters, pre-existing health conditions. A lot of it goes into how I'm trying to simplify this answer, but it can be very difficult, even for an astute physician, to recognize pesticide poisoning. So they're probably underreported. But it can also be very difficult for a physician who's got a lot of experience and expertise in pesticides to say anything definitive without biological measures, which can be very difficult to take. We don't have a lot of antidotes for pesticides. Most of them don't have anything that we can give besides palliative care of a patient. And then to go even further and make a definitive statement about the chronic health effects, cancer or other systemic effects, is extremely difficult. Not only for pesticides, it's widespread throughout toxicology. There's nothing unique about pesticides in our inability to make very definitive statements about exposure X caused Y. It applies to personal care products. In some cases, it actually applies to pharmaceuticals. So it's a difficult subject. I've once heard it best summarized by the former administrator of the Office of Pesticide Programs as, it's not rocket science. If it was, we'd have figured it out. It's more complex.
Just one quick follow-up. One concern. You mentioned age. I'm 74. Am I more susceptible, you think?
Representative Krieger, I'm assuming you're a very healthy 74.
According to Representative Fredericks, I'm not.
yes. In fact, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, recently issued guidelines for the first time on risk assessment to account for an aging population. We have an aging population certainly in agriculture, so it is definitely a concern of mine. In fact, I gave presentations regionally and nationally about this last year about how to consider aging in when we consider risk and how to consider the effect of aging with exposure, but also with not only pre-existing health conditions, but the fact that most people as they age will be on at least one other pharmaceutical, and we don't know the interactions between pharmaceuticals and pesticides. There's just been no research in that field.
Representative Whitsitt, very quickly, Representative Reardon, did you have anything? Thank you, sir.
I just wondered if any of you know about how many laws or rules are in Oregon statute already regarding pesticide and herbicide application, and if you feel that we have adequate protection from spraying human beings. It is against the law, I believe, right, to spray human beings. So I guess I'm asking, do we just need to enforce the laws that we have versus creating new laws? Sort of just a short answer there.
In my opinion, Oregon should be very proud of having an Oregon Forest Practices Act, and that provides lots of regulatory oversight of how we practice forestry and the tools that we use. My sense is that if we apply that law, that will take us a long way.
And that was Dr. Tesher responding to Representative Whitsitt. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, you have been, I think, exceptionally helpful in assisting us to understand how pesticides are used in the very real world and their use as a tool in a very real world. For that, I thank each of you very, very much. That your testimony has been exceedingly valuable. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I am going to ask that we're going to shift gears here a little bit, and the committee is going to entertain some potential committee bills. I think that it is important that we at least have a conceptual notion of what it is that we would be voting on, what those bills intend to try and accomplish. I do not want testimony on the bill. I want a 20-second statement on what the bill hopes to accomplish. And with that, I would like to call forward Al Elkins for LC 1162, Representative Krieger for LC 1435 and LC 400, and Vice Chair Frederick for his invasive species LC that I am not sure what the number is.
I will find 2611.
2611. And the members of the committee can do it from their seats. Mr. Elkins, can you tell us briefly what 1162 attempts to do?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. This is the bill that allows for county-by-county vote on the ability to use dogs to hunt cougars. It passed the House last session, 44-19, I believe.
All right.
And we would like to continue the discussion on this issue.
All right, fine. Thank you very, very much, sir. Appreciate that background. Next, I'd like to shift to Representative Krieger. Could you tell us what 1435 attempts to accomplish?
Mr. Chair, I don't have it in front of me, but it is one of the predator bills. We had two that came forward. One of them has to do with the endangered species, and the other, I think, is a statewide program, and that's the one I believe that this is.
Okay.
And it's a concept that's been in place, or the idea has been in place for a couple different sessions.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, but I can never, I always have a hard time hearing you, so I need to ask you to speak up just a little bit, please, because, thank you.
I think that might be your bill. Yeah, this is the draft here, but it talks about the Department of State and Fish and Wildlife to study developing a predator management program and then report that back in the interim to the committee. Several states have a statewide management program for their predators. I believe Utah's got probably one of the best ones that's successful now. We'd like to take a look and get testimony on that.
Thank you very much. And Representative Krieger, just a couple of seconds on LC 400.
LC 400 is a concept that would be referred to the people through a referendum.
Mm-hmm.
And it says here that a proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution established the right to hunt, fish, trap, and harvest wildlife and use traditional methods to hunt, fish, and trap wildlife, refers to proposed amendment to the people. This concept has also moved forward, I think now has been adopted in 18 states, to try to protect our rural culture that involves hunting and mm-hmm. fishing. And here again, I think it would be great for Oregon.
Thank you very much. And lastly, Vice Chair Frederick, you showed me an LC concept earlier today.
Yes.
That if you could describe that one, please.
Sure. This is dealing with groups and companies growing Arundo Dornax. Dornax, Arundo Dornax is known as the giant cane. It is being suggested that if it's being grown for commercial purposes, you need to file a bond with the Invasive Species Council in case it does, in fact, escape. And the idea is for the council to make loans to eradicate or mitigate any of the spreading Arundo Dornax. And it makes a violation of the bond requirement subject to civil penalty not to exceed $25,000 for each day the violation continues.
Thank you. And Vice Chair Frederick, for the record, that LC number is?
2611.
Thank you very much. Committee members, You have the conceptual background on these bills. We have received requests to put these forward as committee bills. Are there any of these particular bills that I'd like to approve them all as a group, as committee bills? Is there any one of them that any of the committee members wants to pull out that you would not want to see go forward as a committee bill? I want to emphasize that our vote today would not be whether you approve or disapprove of the bill, just to simply allow it to move forward as a committee-sponsored bill. It has no positive or negative connotation. Presumably. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. But for the committee, we usually just bring forward bills just for a discussion purpose at least.
Yes.
You know, whether you like it or not, we bring those forward so we can discuss them in a public venue.
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much for that clarification. I am not seeing.
Go ahead.
Not seeing anyone object to a packaged vote here. Representative Frederick.
Chair Witt, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1162, dated 9/29/2014; LC 1435, dated 11/24/14. LC 400, dated 6/13/14, and LC 2611, dated 11/20/14.
Thank you very much. Representative Frederick moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1162, dated September 29th, 2014, LC 1435, dated November 24th, 2014, LC 400, dated June 13th, 14, and LC 2611, dated November 20th, 2014. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection? Not seeing any, they're adopted as committee bills. Committee members, thank you very much. And With that, I want to thank Mr. Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I made a mistake. I added a few members to the House in that vote. It was 40-19, not 44-19.
Mr. Chair, I almost looked it up because I remember Representative Frederick saving my bacon there with that 40th vote. Because it required a supermajority, and I remember him being number 40. And so I looked it up, but I didn't want to embarrass you.
Oh, it's 44. Yeah.
Thank you for making sure we have an accurate record, Mr. Elkins. Appreciate that very much. Thank you, committee members. Our last session this evening, this afternoon, we have 45 minutes to discuss the aggregate and concrete industries' contributions to our state's economy. And with that, I'd like to call up, please, Rich Angstrom, and please invite, if you have a panel, to invite everyone up. Good afternoon to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Hi, thank you.
Appreciate very much your patience as we have worked through our agenda. Certainly look forward to your presentation here. Please proceed. Determine among yourselves how you will.
First of all,
thank you, Chair Witt.
How you
we're playing musical chairs here, trying to figure out the system and the mouse here. So I'm the least technology-oriented person of this group, I promise you. So there we go. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. Thank you for having allowing us to come here and talk about our industry. After listening to the pesticide discussion, I think you're going to find this a little more stimulating and very interesting on just the scope of what we do and some of the cool things that we're embarking on as far as advances in our industry. So with that said, an overview real quick. I'm going to talk about the size and scope of the industry. Casey Klosterman, who's kind of our economic guru, is not here today. He got called to Montana to do some business. And so I'm going to do the economic data and go through that pretty quick. And then we're going to talk about sustainability, choosing a construction material, innovations, and then some challenges. So our presenters, myself, Casey's not here, Tian Ping from National Ready Mix Association, Brad Moyes from KPFF Consulting Engineers, and Dave Frentress, Cal Portland, who has testified before several committees in the past. He's our kind of wild card, so we're most enthused about his testimony. With that said, one of the things I wanted to just say as a kind of the lead off this whole discussion is it's amazing how with our industry people think of us as more flat work and sidewalks and curbs and driveways. And we are so much more than that. And that's one of the things we wanted to show you today is how much we do and how diversified our industry is. And so lots of flat work pictures here. You'll notice a lot of labor working on them. They're screeding the concrete there to make it flat. On this particular picture, this just is one that shows another flat work, but as rebar and steel, we work with the steel folks pretty closely. On this one, this particular picture, concrete intersections, one of the things we've done as far as advances of, from a society is moved away from doing asphalt in the intersections because the sheer forces of cars going around, concrete just holds up a whole lot better, and we've been able to protect our roads from that kind of thing. Here we have the lane transit district, and let me flip the page as I missed it. The lane, this is a hub that connects Eugene and Springfield, and there's about 11,400 cubic yards, but if you put that in terms of trucks, it's about 1,140 trucks, so a 10-yard truck. So you can think about whenever we talk about cubic yards, put it in terms of trucks. That's over 1,000 trucks to do this particular particular project. So transit, streets. One of the things here on the concrete roads, as I move forward here to concrete roads, is
One is they're very durable, but this is a very interesting one because they actually had to raise the roadbed. And this Moody Avenue in Portland, they had to raise it 14 feet and then pour it from there. And this is a very durable product from roads that will last a long time. I think we think that it's going to be about a 50 or 60-year road. But to pour it, it took about 1,800 yards a day to pour this thing. Obviously, bridges, you guys are used to seeing our industry doing bridge work. This is the Port of Portland, and this is all EIC winners. These are Excellence in Concrete winners. This is a huge project that had 60,000 cubic yards of material in it, or 6,000 trucks to complete. It was LEED certified in platinum, and you can just see the size and scope of this particular concrete project. But the interesting thing was, is when it was all finished, that they tried to design it in a way that looked like an airplane wing or kind of a hull of a ship, and it actually has a green roof for carbon-related purposes. So moving on, this particular one, going to water storage and treatment, this was quite a design feat to build this because all the pressure on that concrete wall from that water is substantial. In order to for this to work, this is a highly technical concrete. These guys could probably talk about it more than I can, but if you listen to the presentations on this, you'd be pretty amazed. Now, this won actually a Craftsman Award, and this is the Coquille City Wastewater Treatment Facility. And the fish actually were set in the form, and then when we poured it, it set there's the form right there. It set that in the concrete, and so we were able to design the concrete in a very cool way. Wow. For that particular facility. Now, tilt-ups, this is one of our bigger projects. This takes a lot of manpower, and these are poured-in-place tilt-ups. And we pour these slabs, and then we tilt them up into place. And this is market choice in Eugene. So when we were all done, you ended up with that market. And it was all done right there on site with concrete. We do dams. This was a hydro adding power to Dorena. And that's the final product there. We also do Soda Springs Fish Dam Passage. This is one of the things we do to help out getting fish moving around the river systems. And actually, there's a couple of them now. There's one up the Santiam River here. And then this one is over by Tokatee Falls. And it ended up being about 660 feet of fish passage, all in concrete. And I think the number of concrete was 27... 1,000 cubic yards or 2,700 trucks. But one of the interesting things about this one is the design on this, because the block pours were so big, we had to control heat. And if anybody knows much about concrete, when you pour it, it heats up. That's part of the curing process that goes along with it. And these big blocks, they had to use a low cement ratio to try to control the heat in order for the whole project to work. So moving along to, this is an ICF house. We are actually in the housing market now, and we build concrete homes. Now, who wouldn't want that? And this is a single-family residence. We don't have a big market share, but we do think we're very proud of this product. We're going to talk about it a little more, but it has a lot of really positive attributes as far as fire resistance and thermal resistance, great energy efficiency. These are becoming more popular, and they're not just on the high end now. We're actually getting down to where some of the middle class folks can afford to put these in. Mirabella in Portland is a high-rise residential. That's a huge project. In fact, this particular one, if I remember right, is like 500,000 square feet, 365 feet tall. It took about 2,900 truckloads of concrete to build it. So that's quite a dimension going up. So here is a multifamily, and this was a 16-floor, 371,000 square foot multifamily housing, and that's the finished product there. This one I actually think is one of the more interesting things. This is the Veronia School. And in this, there's a 50,000-gallon tank of water that's fueled by biofuel, that's heated by biofuel. And it, then throughout the whole school, there's all of this tubing that goes under the concrete floors. And it heats and cools the building using both our industry and one of the topics you just talked about, which is biomass and how it's disposed. So Veronia is using a local source of biomass to heat that school. And that's what it looks like. I didn't go to a school like that. I went to Butte Creek, and I'm telling you, it did not look like that. So last thing, armed forces, and just real quick on the armed forces thing, this is, again, just a tilt-up, but we wanted to show you that all the things we get involved in, whether it's military applications, residential, it's just not flat work. We're much more than sidewalks and curbs as far as an industry. So with that, it's always interesting to know just the economics around what our industry is about. And I'm going to go through this pretty quick. But there's the first two slides are the most important ones. Public agencies purchase more than half of all construction aggregates, currently nearly 65%. And they go to highways and then everything else you saw there, water, water and waste treatment facilities, public offices, shops, and schools. Public agencies use about 35% of the concrete produced. But from an aggregate perspective, because such a big demand, you can see why we're always here trying to secure a source of aggregate, because so much of it is used for public purposes. On average, every person in Oregon uses 8 to 12 tons of aggregate. Now, to put that in perspective, every one of you uses one dump truck load of aggregate. Whether you know it or not, it's going to roads or bridges or your schools. One dump truck load. The average consumption of ready mix is about 3/4 of a yard to 1.2 yards per person in Oregon, and that's assuming our population, which is 3.96 million, excuse me. So as far as employment, one of the things that when I looked at this, the point of this particular slide is you'd be surprised how few people are employed directly in our industry. And this is just direct. It's not then, from the AGC side, all of the construction guys. But these are the guys that are just producing the aggregates or the ready mix. Currently, the estimate is about 3,500 people, and we probably peaked in 2006 at about 5,000 people. And this is for aggregate, so that's for mining the aggregates. And the economic aspects of that are actually pretty interesting. If you look at this graph, and I don't have a pointer, but if you looked at the U.S. trends for aggregate, which is the blue line, and the Oregon's, which is the red line, they fairly mirror each other. You can see the big peak in 2005 and 2006, and we went from 50 million tons of aggregate down to around 30 million tons, and we've been hovering right in that range. That's a pretty big drop in the demand of aggregate. Nationally, it mirrored that. The one thing that Casey believes, and he really does know his stuff, is he thinks, and this is important for you guys, my colleagues and I had a tease a little bit about aggregate or aggregate first or rock first, gravel first. First thing that goes down in any economic development is a load of rock. And once capacity is filled up of other buildings, the first thing for development is going to be a layer of rock. And it's a great economic indicator. And so that's why this is important. In 2014, we think we're going to be at 29 million tons. In 2015, we'll be at 28 million tons. And then most of that is we see the public sector declining significantly, mostly because the federal highway folks are really struggling over funding the highways, and we really haven't had a comprehensive highway discussion here to solve many of our problems. On the ready mix side, same, 2,800 current employees, 4,000 in the peak. And you can see we cut in half the ready mix production in the state from the peak, and we really haven't bounced up much more than that. It's kind of a sad picture. The positive, though, I suppose, is that at least PCA, the Portland Cement Association, believes that the public agencies will be flat in the ready mix side, but the residential and commercial will start to increase. So we think that's a positive sign, at least from the ready mix side. Demand for construction aggregates, concrete, as well as asphalt is highly affected by public agency demand. Roads and bridges, maintenance and improvements are the single largest consumers of these material. And then, you know, this is the pitch for, I suppose, that we do need to start solving some of our infrastructure-related problems. So data source, thank everybody there, U.S. Bureau of Mines, Department of Geology, PCA, Ashgrove, Jeff Mendez, thanks a lot. You provided a lot of that information. Old Castle Materials and U.S. Census. And with that, I'll introduce Tian. The court only reaches so far.
That's right.
Chair of the committee, my name is Tian Peng. I'm with the National Ready Mix Concrete Association. And for the record, I live in Shoreline, Washington.
Welcome to our committee.
Thanks. I've been here before, actually.
Yes.
Once before. So before I talk about the role of concrete's role in sustainability, I'd like to clarify a few terms, which is that cement and concrete are often used interchangeably. And, you know, you don't walk on a cement sidewalk, you walk on a concrete sidewalk, because cement is really the binding agent that glues all the other elements, water, aggregate, rock, sand, and you know, other elements into what would be concrete. And so just for clarification, and does cement have a carbon footprint? Yes, that's a big topic, and certainly the carbon embodied carbon content of concrete is mostly in cement because of the production of cement, and on the average, it's a pound of carbon to a pound of cement produced. And so, if you look at the energy consumption in the U.S., that for industry in the industry sectors, you'll see that cement manufacturing is actually a really small percentage of the energy consumption for manufacturing. And so the making of cement, and we talk a lot about embodied carbon footprint of a material. Embodied means the material, raw material acquisition, the production or manufacturing, and the construction of a project, let's say a building. But the taking a life cycle perspective includes the use phase, which is really the largest phase where has a tremendous impact on the environmental impacts. And so life cycle is understood as the most important consideration, and many other standards out there, ASHRAE, International Green Building Codes, as well as Green Globes, LEED, all consider life cycle perspective when they're looking at materials. And you see that in a life cycle perspective, a building, a project, a building has 95% of its carbon footprint in its use phase. And so concrete is a material that can benefit this use phase and because it has inherent thermal qualities. And that inherent thermal quality, architects, engineers have been taking advantage of for thousands of years. This is why we can live, people have lived in the harshest of environments we see over here. Thermal quality basically makes use of, is one of the elements in passive solar design, and it takes advantage of the natural laws of heat movement and heat storage mechanisms. And so here are some examples of what's used for thermal mass, really just mass materials. It could be water, it could be, you know, rock, concrete, and those are the materials that are heavy and can utilize their thermal properties. And so here in Oregon, you see the Oregon Health Systems University Building 1 has taken advantage of integrating passive and active solar technologies to yield operating cost savings of $600,000 annually. And because they downsized the mechanical system, they saved $3.2 million on initial capital costs. So this is a success story when you're looking at green building, certainly. And of course, the green building movement has grown exponentially. In this state, around the country, building owner interest in saving money from operational costs certainly fuel that growth, and the state of Oregon is such an owner. And of course, the U.S. Green Building Council has led the way in a lot of these in their LEED rating systems, which you've heard about many times before. This graph is a little off, but LEED is divided into credit categories, and there are five main categories plus two bonus categories. And you can see here that, in fact, concrete is the only material to contribute directly or indirectly to every single credit category. With each new evolution and draft of these green rating systems, such as LEED, it has evolved because our understanding of sustainability has evolved. And so we used to talk about recycled content as a proxy for what's green, or how far did you have to truck that material, and that would indicate green. But now all these rating systems are starting to say that, in fact, there are is a holistic way of looking at what is green that considers all the attributes. And this can be embodied energy, which is just the, you know, the manufacturing and recycling phase. But it could be also things such as biodiversity loss or land use or toxicity. And so these are important aspects that we haven't considered before, human health as well. And so the movement is towards more transparency in our materials and how we use them in the buildings. And the concrete industry has led the way in developing new documents, third-party verified, peer-reviewed research that support this transparency movement. And finally, I'm going to talk about resiliency, which is we see that more and more there's another benefit to using long-lasting, durable materials, and that is when you look at the example here in the Oregon Resilience Plan that was developed last year, we see a huge gap between within our critical infrastructure and buildings that will have a tremendous effect on the Oregon economy as well as the regional and national economies. And that gap is where the state's critical infrastructure is right now and where it needs to be, according to the report. And so we see examples every day of failing infrastructure. And here's the Minnesota example. If you remember a few years ago, the I-35 West span collapsed, killing a number of people and injuring many others. And within 2 years, they rebuilt it from that old steel structure to this concrete structure that will last over 100 years. And so the industry has worked tremendously hard in developing resilience in communities, and we've demonstrated leadership by partnering with a lot of national agencies, FEMA, NIST, and insurance agencies to create a lot of support documents to minimize the risk of natural hazards. So thank you.
Chair Witt and committee, my name is Brad Moyes. I'm a structural engineer and principal with KPFF Consulting Engineers in Portland. I'm going to talk about choosing construction materials for building framing. And my interest as a structural engineer is having the flexibility to pick those materials to be the appropriate ones for each building that I work on and our firm works on. So structural materials are typically there are four structural materials that are used in building framing. The first is concrete, and that includes both cast-in-place concrete and precast. Cast-in-place concrete comes to the site in ready-mix trucks that have been talked about. Precast is structural elements that are cast, such as Knifeberger's plant in Harrisburg. They're cast in the plant and then trucked to the construction sites. Steel, masonry, and wood are the other major materials that are used for building structure. Typically, the structural materials are covered up by finishes, but sometimes they're exposed, as some of the examples that have been shown. So some projects will use all of these materials. Others will use only concrete. Concrete is somewhat unique in that it's used in virtually all building projects and foundations, if nothing else. And so the other materials are used as necessary. Some of the code requirements that dictate what those materials would be are come from the building code, which is the Oregon Structural Specialty Code. In design of buildings, we need to consider gravity forces, which are the weight of the materials in the building and the contents, plus people that are in the buildings. The other consideration is lateral forces, which are both wind and earthquake forces that act on the buildings. Blast resistance is important in many public buildings. It's something we didn't consider until 9/11, but it's an important consideration anymore. Fire resistance is determined by the size of the building, both square footage and height, the use of the building, the property setbacks of the building. Materials, concrete, steel, and masonry are considered non-combustible and can be used in any size building. Wood is typically limited to four or five stories, depending on the jurisdiction. So building life cycle considerations are another factor in determining what those structural materials are. The design life of the building. A spec building may have a 40 or 50-year life. Higher ed building could have a 100-year life, and so many times the materials used are different for those considerations. Future flexibility of the building is important. A lot of interior bearing walls in a building don't allow for very good flexibility in the future if it's a hospital and you have a lot of change in the uses, and so that typically is avoided. The use and feel of the building, floor deflections and vibration are important considerations. And then in Western Oregon, long-term maintenance from water intrusion is a very important consideration. So rot and corrosion of materials need to be considered. The buildings need to be protected from these issues. So Tien talked at length about sustainability considerations. The choice of structural materials is fairly limited impact on the scoring for these sustainability rating systems. It's important to use recycled materials, also local materials. You get credit for those. But by and large, the long-term energy use of a building is the biggest driver in coming up with the LEED scoring. So over the life cycle of the building, that energy usage dwarfs anything that that you do at the front end during construction of a building. Other considerations in choosing materials are cost, schedule, how fast can you build the building, what the availability is of material and labor. And then often it comes down to the preference of the owner. The design team is usually led by the architect, of which we're a team member. And many times you have a contractor involved, too, that is making this consideration. So all of these factors go into determining what is used for construction of a building. I will turn it over to David.
Yeah, I think you just passed me a microphone.
Thank you, Brad.
Chair Witt and the rest of the committee. I'm Dave Frentress, and I'm a ready-mix producer. So I work for a company that puts it all together. So we buy cement, and we buy aggregates, and we're the guys with the plants and the trucks and the concrete pumps and so forth. So we bring it out to the job site per the contractor's order. So people say, why would you spend 38 years in the concrete industry? Because it's fun. So we innovate like crazy. I've seen a lot of changes in my 38 years and so forth. This is a building done in Portland, and the design was for an anatomy college. And so the architect wanted the columns to look like kidneys, so he designed a form, and there we are. So you can pretty much do anything with concrete except it's structural, and there's the building when it's finished. So you can see that we're managing water with concrete as well. It comes off the roof, and we handle it that way. A cool thing about structural concrete walls is with one of our new mixes, SCC, it's self-consolidating concrete, and it can mimic the form perfectly. And so this type of wall eliminates a finish. So it's pretty green as far as being a structural element as well as a decorative element, and then it's done. And so that offers you a real nice looking wall with no splinters whatsoever. Very interesting. This type of technology was used on a church up in Vancouver. And as you can see, it's structural as well as decorative, and it handles water as well with the built-in cistern there and so forth. And this church will obviously be quite durable. And it's beautiful as well. This was done by Marion Construction right here in Salem, and it's a gorgeous example of concrete. What I like about it is you can drive by it on a different day, and it looks totally different every day, depending on how the sun hits it or if it's wet or not, and no finishes whatsoever. This is the tallest building in Clark County in Vancouver, and this was built in 12 days. It's 300 feet tall, and it just appeared. And so a lot of people use our product because of speed and the owner. It's very durable and so forth, and very economical. He couldn't build this any other way with that type of economy. And the material is very diverse, and it can be decorative, durable, functional as well. This is a job up in the Puget Sound area where they just embedded different colors of glass within the concrete and then ground it. Really nice effect from plain boring concrete. So we have a lot of innovation going on. And we're innovating in all directions on all fronts. So it's pretty fun. This is acid staining. Again, we eliminate finishes and coatings, tile, vinyl, all that sort of thing. So it's a greener product for that application, and it gives the owner a very low-maintenance, economical surface to work with. So it's very valuable to those owners. Also, we can take old concrete using similar techniques and renovate it. The original slab in this warehouse in Portland was poured in the 20s, and with polishing and coloring, we can renovate that slab, don't need to replace it, and that gives you that long life cycle. These are the insulating concrete forms that Rich alluded to earlier. This is a Habitat project up in Portland, and they're self-performing basements. They just love the product. We place concrete right in the middle there, and so it's kind of like an Oreo. The good stuff is in the middle. And we can go pretty high with this product as well. This is a six-story in Portland, right next to the historic Lane building. The family has owned that other building since the 20s, so they said, we're not going to go anywhere, so we should probably use concrete. So we went up six stories, and you don't see any concrete, so I call that ICF invisible concrete framing and so forth. Nice thing is for the owner, it's severe energy savings. It'll save 50%. And so the utility bills for those people in those condos are very, very reasonable. It also offers a 3-hour fire rating at no extra charge, so that's value to that owner. Here's concrete being placed in one of those insulating concrete form homes and so forth. And the forms stay in place. We have one over here, and they are your insulation, your vapor barrier, so it eliminates sheeting and Tyvek, all that sort of thing, and the energy savings are tremendous. So this house will perform. His bills are about 30% of what the bills of the house on the right are. This is in government camp, so it's a pretty severe climate up there, and hence the metal roof and the steep sides and so forth. But again, you don't see any concrete. It kind of hides there. We have a display here for pervious concrete as well. It's a special type of concrete that we don't use any sand in it, so water can pass right through it. So it has voids built right into it. Normally, we try and make concrete dense. Well, in this case, we throw those engineers a curveball. Sorry about that, Brad. And we make it intentionally porous so it can eliminate stormwater runoff, eliminate the need for a bioswale and all that sort of thing. So water runs right through it, and we can infiltrate stormwater right on site. So it's quite an encouraging, exciting new technology. We go to Las Vegas every year, about 50 leaders in the industry, and there it is, taking a shower. Yeah. So we perform new testing, new finishing techniques to innovate with this type of a product. And we're going so fast that we learn new things every year when we go. So it's quite exciting. And we're applying the same decorative type of techniques to the pervious as we do other concretes. This is a two-layer pervious concrete that we designed, and we use a big aggregate on the bottom and the small material on top because it was kind of uneconomical for us to use a pea gravel all the way through. And this is another effort of our industry to save cement because that larger aggregate needs less cement to coat it. So we can do that mix with only 250 pounds of cement and then come back with the mix that has 500 pounds on the top in a very economical way and so forth. And this mix also illustrates the importance of aggregates for a person in my standpoint, because I need quality aggregates to make a good concrete mix with in various sizes and shapes, that sort of thing. So the aggregate industry is very important to us and so forth. So we're moving quickly, and we're always pleased to illustrate the things that you can do with concrete. Thank you for your time.
Flip the slide one more spot, and I think I have summary. And one more on top of that. One of the things that we did is we did give some examples that we wanted you guys to look at. I don't know if I can pick this up. No, that's not too bad. But this is a...
Somebody get that for you?
Yeah, this is the cylinder for the ICF and how we're insulating and building homes out of that. The thing I broke, actually, I've seen this where you can pour a hose on this thing. And it'll just, all the water will run right through. It's just amazing how we're using it for stormwater runoff and treating stormwater, where we don't have to collect it in a basin or anything like that. So the things we're innovating on trying to help out communities control, you know, pollutants and energy costs are amazing. The challenges, and I think that's the important thing for the committee to think about, and we'd love you guys just kind of check that out and talk to the guys after the meeting here. But we still are challenged in Oregon about getting an affordable, constant supply of aggregate material. Getting the aggregate is a big challenge, as many of you know, because you've all been part of the gravel wars here. The speed of permitting, I've been listening to, or I've been reading some studies that I was prepping for this, and the average time to get a mine site permitted, aggregate or otherwise, is 10 years. It's 10 years. It's just too long, is the point. Some of the things you may not be as aware of that I focus on is that one of our other challenges is retaining, training and retaining a qualified workforce. Our ready mix trucks and all of those finishers are high skilled, family wage, by the way. They're all family wage jobs, but they're high skilled jobs. It's a different thing to go out and drop off a load of staples or, you know, lumber or something like that. But it's another thing to come out and drop off a load of concrete. Those guys have to be trained on all the mix designs, what's in their truck, and how much water they can put in, how many revolutions their trucks can turn before the concrete's no good anymore. All of those kinds of things are part of the training that goes on with our ready mix drivers, and we're not finding a lot of them right now. It's a real challenge. If you listen to the guys right back behind us here, that's one of the things that every day I hear about is trying to find qualified labor out there to do what we do. The last thing is, and you guys haven't heard much about this as far as a committee yet, because it'll surface in the transportation committee, is there's going to be another 800 bridges that are going to be limited because of the old modeling for highways and how they looked at bridges has changed, and the new truck configurations aren't working. And the Federal Highway Administration has came down and said, you guys got a problem with your bridges. We move heavy products. Our ready-mix trucks are typically a 68,000-pound truck, and then our aggregate trucks run all the way up to 105,000 pounds. And the reason we do that is so it's the economies of scale and its efficiency to get the product out to the highway jobs. And that's going to be one of our biggest challenges is if they start weight limiting bridges, our highest cost associated with our industry is our transportation costs. It's more than the mining. It's more than all the other components. Our transportation costs are our number one driver. And if we have to start moving around all these weight limited bridges or reducing our loads and we're delivering to public works projects, it's going to be a lot more expensive. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present our industry to this committee. We're very excited about all the stuff. I know you can see even the enthusiasm amongst us. And Dave actually contained himself pretty well over there. So that was good. And thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments? Representative Krieger?
Rich, you mentioned the difficulty of getting employees. Do most of your companies, I assume the truck drivers, equipment operators, are they drug tested?
Yes.
What's going to happen if they have marijuana?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, our position still is that our drug policies are our drug policies, and what the state does may be different than what a private company does as far as its policy. But we're all learning. As you know, you're a past police officer, me as a past prosecutor. Now that we've legalized marijuana, we don't really know what the definition of under the influence means anymore. In fact, the police, my police friends are telling me pretty consistently that they are not sure how they're going to be processing those types of cases. But from a business management perspective, let me just put it this way. We do not want somebody stoned driving a 105,000-pound truck down I-5. That is crazy.
Or operating a rock crusher.
Or a rock crusher.
Anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I'm off topic a little bit on this, but I've now seen two people smoking bongs going down I-5, where I've just looked over and I've watched them puffing on it. And, you know, the voters spoke, and I'm fine with that. But, you know, from a societal side and a business side, which is what your question is, we still have to protect the public. And that's, you know, my advice to my members is going to be maintain your policies. If you have a drug-free policy, that should continue to include marijuana. The courts eventually are going to speak on this.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Woodson.
I have a question, which is something I don't know. If you have, for example, 1,000 pounds of CO2 emitted, what is the actual weight of carbon? Is it 50% then, because carbon is like 14 atomic weight and the oxygens are 7, you have two of them. So does it come out, like when CO2 comes out? We're hearing a lot of interchangeable carbon emissions, and they really mean carbon dioxide emissions, right? And so I'm trying to figure out, I've had this question put to me before, when you talk about carbon emissions, how much is really carbon and how much is oxygen, and do you cut it in half then?
Yeah, I'll address that. It's you don't cut anything in half. When they're saying carbon, they mean carbon dioxide. And
right.
When they say carbon dioxide, they mean carbon dioxide equivalent. Because all the other gases in the greenhouse gases, methane, nitric right. oxide, they also have equivalencies to carbon dioxide. So it's really carbon dioxide E equivalent.
Okay, so no carbon. Somebody asked me, and I didn't really know on that, because they use them interchangeably all
right.
the time.
Right, I think it's the new slang.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, you know there's talk about a carbon tax also, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the number is $150 per ton of carbon. We estimate, and we were doing some math just from our industry, what that would do is there's about 450 pounds of cement in an average 10-yard load, all right?
Average yard.
Per yard.
Per yard. 4,500 pounds in a 10-yard load. We think that that rate would be equivalent to about a $35 to $40 increase just in the price of concrete per yard, because the tax on the cement industry. That's a huge tax. Yes. And we'll be obviously playing part of that discussion. But it is something that's worth noting that we, because of our carbon footprint, we need to be engaged in that discussion.
And what are we talking about in terms of the cost of a yard delivered?
I would say, I'll let these guys talk. But
it's about $100 a cubic yard on average, so that would raise it to 140 or so. So it's a pretty significant bite. Yeah,
very significant. Representative Reardon.
Well, I am watching the clock, so I but just real quick. So, Rich, I would love to talk to you about what we're doing this coming session on workforce development and career technical ed and stuff, if you want to drop up some time and chat about that. I think I'd love to have you involved with it.
Chair Witt and Representative Reardon, we'd love to be. It's a major concern of ours.
And then the second one is been working on an affordable housing work group, and we had a presentation this morning talking about that. During all those probably 10 meetings we had, I didn't have anybody ever talk to me about different construction models. So I'm thinking of anywhere from single family to, you know, modest multifamily. I'm not talking, you know, super high-rise, anything like that. But do you have anybody that's really working on an affordable housing? Because there's a tremendous opportunity there.
Be me.
That would be you?
Look at Minnesota, 10% of the home starts are this type of material, and they're doing 24 high-rises in Waterloo, Ontario, where I went to graduate school for student housing, because it's affordable and it's fast.
Well, maybe we could hook up sometime and chat a little bit more about that, and if you don't mind.
I mean, can you imagine?
Gentlemen, it's been an absolutely fascinating presentation, truly fascinating. I'm presuming that any of the committee members who are interested in exploring some of this more in depth, if they wanted a tour of some kind of site where you have concrete applications, they'd be free to get in touch with you and could explore that maybe more in depth.
We'd love that opportunity. Thank you, Chair.
Fantastic. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
And with that, we stand adjourned. We stand adjourned. Very much.
Thank you very much.
And with that,